Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1996.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, and so forth and so on, etc. Across all these many time zones, from the Hawaiian and Tahitian Islands across this great nation to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, then down into South America, north to the pole. Worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM, top of the morning. I'm Art Bell. A few announcements and a real cosmic voyage ahead. Because tonight, as promised, a tenured PhD professor at Emory University, Dr. Courtney Brown, heads a group of remote viewers at something called the Farsight Institute. And this is one of the most fascinating topics that one can imagine. So all the way from the home of the newly opened Olympic Games, Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Brown will come. And the Olympics, of course, have torched off, as it were. I've received a number of fax complaints about the coverage of the opening of the Olympics. That is to say, network news anchors talking with each other over crowd noise, and I guess it didn't impress a lot of people because I've received a lot of faxes. Also, this one just in Atlanta, Georgia. This is America. Razor wire, bomb sniffing dogs, stifling heat. Welcome to the new world, I cried when they showed Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay. God, that was good, wasn't it? It was the right thing to do to let him carry that torch. So, they are officially let the games begin, I guess. The Olympics are open. Now, let me make an announcement before we begin, a couple of them. One is, I've got a photograph of the double helix crop circle. And it's on the webpage, the June 17th Alton Barnes double helix crop circle. So, the one we got the other day, Stonehenge, is up there. And now we've got another one, the incredible, spectacular double helix. See if that's what it reminds you of. It's on my webpage. This morning's guest, Dr. Courtney Brown, Professor Brown, also has a webpage. And when you go to my webpage this morning to get one of these crop circle pictures, no doubt, and you want to know more about Cosmic Voyage, about remote viewing, we have a link up, as we usually do, due to the attentiveness of my webmaster, Keith Rowland. You will see that link, and you can jump over to the good doctor's webpage. So if you want to get the new double helix crop circle photograph, they're incredible, just incredible, or any of the above, go to my webpage, please, www.artbell.com. That's www, stands for World Wide Web. artbell.com. Name of that tune. Also, for those of you into the chatting thing, my son is now in the Periscope room on AOL, America Online. So if you can get to America Online, simply hit keyword, type in the name Art Bell, away you will be whisked to the land of the grassy knoll. And you'll see my photograph up there, and when you see somebody named Art Bell, it will actually be my son. And then just click on the chat area called the Grassy Knoll. Now, there's a good name for a chat area, the Grassy Knoll chat area. And you will be whisked in, and you will see my son in there chatting with you. So, let's see, I think those are most of the notes I will tell you more about Dr. Brown in just a moment.
You- You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
All right, are you strapped in? Are you ready? Courtney Brown, Dr. Brown, Professor Brown, PhD, is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta, specializing in nonlinear mathematical modeling of social phenomena, environmental politics, and elections. He held the Charles Grove Haynes Professorship at UCLA and was a Hewlett Fellow at the Carter Presidential Center. He is the author of several books, including Serpents in the Sand. Sounds interesting. Essays on the Nonlinear Nature of Politics. I like that title. And Human Destiny and Chaos and Catastrophe Theories, both published in 1995. The Good Doctor heads a group of remote viewers at a place called the Farsight Institute, and one of their main targets, I understand, has been Mars. But let us begin at the beginning. Doctor, welcome to the program. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. And Art, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me on your show. It is truly a great honor.
Well, it is a great honor to have you, and I can assure you over the last weeks and months, I have been inundated with faxes and email and so forth and so on saying, you've got to get Dr. Brown on. So,
well, these are kind words.
All right. I guess for our new listeners, and we have many, who have not and don't understand, have not heard what remote viewing is, it would be in order. I've got a sort of a written description you sent me here, but I'd rather have your words. Doctor, for the uninitiated, what is remote viewing?
Well, remote viewing, quite simply, is a mental procedure. Now, it's a trainable mental procedure and enables a person to extract accurate, descriptive information from distant locations. Now, remote viewing also works across time, in the sense that the remote viewer can, you know, extract information from the past, present, or future, totally transparent with regard to time, as if time doesn't exist. In fact, we know now that that's not a metaphor. We know now that in reality, I'll talk about this as the hours go on, but we know now that the absolute fact is time is a limitation of our perception. It is not a real thing.
Is, in fact, time our invention?
Well, that's what many people have been recently discovering, that we may, in fact, in the broader view of things, before our lives and after our lives, be a species that, in fact, help design our current situation and isn't, in fact, an invention. But I think I perhaps should touch upon that a little later on in the show and get a little more background into it. But the reality is time with remote viewing is not a hindrance at all. We can see anything past, present, or future. Scientific remote viewing is the version of remote viewing that I'll be talking about tonight. It refers to, sometimes it's called SRV, scientific remote viewing. It refers to a set of protocols that are a modernized version of the original techniques that were used and developed by the U.S. military in the 1980s and 90s, totally for espionage purposes.
All right, I'll stop you there. And those who don't know, Nightline, ABC's Nightline, did a full show on the military's revelations that they had been using remote viewing in an ongoing project for what, Doctor? 20 years, something like that?
Well, actually, they had been using it operationally during that time period. The 80s was really when it was in its highest point. But the remote viewing studies, the scientific studies funded by the military, had been going on for as long as 30 years. The military had been deeply involved in this for a long time for very, very good reasons. First of all, it did just recently come out that the military was involved in all of this, but it was one of the most highly classified secrets held by our government, basically, since the Manhattan Project.
And I take it, no doubt, the Russians were involved as well.
Well, of course, during the Cold War, there was something on our side for everything that there was on their side, and
right.
vice versa.
Right.
And they had their own psychic warfare espionage program. But they approached it from a different angle from the way the United States did it. We approached it from the perspective of developing a set of procedures that could be trained so that you would not have to rely on natural psychics. And the Soviets went a different route. They developed a set of screening techniques that were used for sorting out the very best natural psychics in all of their territory.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in fact, did develop a program that was very successful. The U.S. military's program had an operational success rate, variously reported, but in general, 85% of the data had to be correct 85% of the time.
Wow.
Now, that was extremely high. That was nothing remotely similar to anything you get with a 1-900 number type of thing. This was a very highly classified project.
All right, let me ask you this, Doctor.
But the Soviets did a
yes.
different thing. They used natural psychics.
And their success rate?
80%. But that means they got to be fairly close to the U.S. accuracy rate. But the Soviet Union came apart, as you know, and it should be noted that their technology for doing this, for setting up a team and getting the procedures set in place that organized the highly trained natural psychics to get this 85% accuracy rate, which was no small task, those procedures were sold to the highest bidders when the Soviet Union collapsed, and
wow.
two countries bought them, and one of those is a perceived enemy of the United States that we have bombed in the past, and so you can be guaranteed, whether you hear about it in the news or not.
Iraq?
Actually, it's so sensitive. There are a couple topics that I don't want to mention specifics.
And we just found out.
But they are countries that we have bombed, that have long memories, that have grudges, and remote viewing will be around for a long time, if for no other reason than for national security interests.
What do you say to somebody who says, baloney, new age, claptrap, what a bunch of silliness. There's no way to document the kind of success rates that people like yourself claim. I'm throwing the worst at you here.
Sure.
How do you respond to that?
Well, this is a very common statement. You must understand that it comes from within a species that is genetically designed to be almost blind to the other side of life. In my book, Cosmic Voyage, quite literally, as the subtitle says, it is a scientific discovery of extraterrestrials visiting Earth. But you must understand that much of the scientific community is hampered by the very fact that we are genetically set up, so to speak, to be so blind to that other side of life. I call that side of life, rather than call it the spirit side or the soul side, I use a more generic term, which is basically there's a whole realm of life that we've now discovered on that other side of life. It's the side where we came from, where the soul is. We are, in fact, part of it. I call it the subspace side of life, and that is, in fact, caught on quite well because it describes a whole arena of existence, and we are, in fact, composite beings with a physical, blood and flesh and bones.
All right, Doctor, let me ask you this. With respect to this side of life, and I agree with you, that but what I'm not sure about is whether it's something we once had and have become numb to in modern civilization and has always been there, or whether it is something we are now refining, acquiring, using more of our brains. Is it something new or something very old that is just now new again?
It goes back to the beginning of existence. You see, remote viewing is innate in every human. You don't have to be talented to do it. You have to be trained to do it. And it goes back, in fact, the earliest remote viewers were the prophets, the ancient seers. And some of them were pretty good. Some of them were very excellent at being able to perceive remotely things across time, across space. In fact, many of our biblical stories are, in fact, fairly accurate remote viewing perceptions. In my book, Cosmic Voyage, for example, there's a chapter on Adam and Eve. And that was a very interesting target to look at, because at first we thought that was just a biblical story.
You looked at it?
Oh, yeah, because it's a very important... We found out that it was a very important thing, because, in fact, see, the remote viewing done by the early seers, they didn't call it remote viewing, of course, but they just had these people who were naturally inclined. They perceived something, but they put it within their own framework of understanding. And these ancient seers perceived in their own trance-like states that there was a somehow a couple involved in the early days of humanity, that somehow there was a dispute, there was a war of some type, that there was some type of a betrayal, and that somehow Adam and Eve were somehow involved in the beginning, the genesis of human life, as the early remote viewers or the early seers knew it. And so when we actually did the remote viewing for this, we found that, in fact, the ancient prophets were pretty good. They got most of it right. What they didn't get is things that they could never understand within their culture, within their time. What they didn't get was that the couple, Adam and Eve, were project managers of a genetic and cultural uplift project. They were
ETs. Holy mackerel.
They came here with ships.
Holy
mackerel.
And
that there was, in fact, a subspace and physical dimensional war, and that the sides did in fact have to take sides.
Doctor, wait. Boy, this is getting heavy fast. Let me stop you again just for a second so that I understand and the audience understands. A practiced professional remote viewer, how does he do it? Do you, in other words, go into a trance state, hear my whole question,
sure,
and then I would like to know, and the audience I'm sure wants to know, is it like, are you looking through somebody else's eyes? Are you physically and having an out-of-body experience and looking at it with your own eyes as though you would stand up in the room? Or in other words, I want to know how you see and what it is that you see.
Okay. What these procedures are, very simply, when you're sitting down at your own desk. And the procedures for a remote viewing session, just the mechanical procedures themselves, take about an hour. There's prep time of about half an hour. There's some analysis and other things that are done afterwards. The total thing takes about 3 hours from start to finish before you're out of there.
Exactly.
But the actual procedures themselves take about an hour. Now, the remote viewing itself, what it is the following. The best way I can tell you what the experience is like when someone is remote viewing during that hour of intensive orientation, it's not an out-of-body experience. That's something different. It is not a trance experience either.
Okay.
What it is a shifting of awareness, a shifting of perception. Now, basically, look at this. What are you looking at now? Now, you don't have to answer, just in general. You're looking at your microphone. Your listeners may be looking at their steering wheel of their car, or they may be looking at something in their homes, or whatever they're looking at. They're looking at something. Now, whatever you're looking at, in your mind's eye, keep your eyes open. Bring in the image of a pencil. Now, with your eyes open, you're still looking at whatever you're looking at, but now you're also looking at the
pencil.
Image of a pencil
right.
In your mind's eye. Now, notice the Eberhardt label. Notice the number 2 on the pencil, the metal band around
yes.
the eraser, the pink eraser, and the sharp point at the other end.
Yes.
Notice that this pencil, which you're now seeing, even though your eyes are open and you're not physically looking at a pencil, you're nonetheless seeing a pencil. And what we have found out is that, this is from the neurologists that found this out, not the remote viewers, they're neurologists, have found out that inside the brain there is a physical layer of cells that basically is in the frontal part and it goes back of the brain, that the ocular image from your eyes is projected onto, literally like a movie screen.
Huh.
And when you see the Eberhardt label, the pencil and everything,
right.
The remembered image is taken from, say, your hard drive of the memory.
Okay.
It's taken from your memory and projected onto that same screen. But notice that image of the pencil. Notice it's a little transparent. It's a little translucent in the sense that you can see through it. It's
yes.
not as bright an image as the stuff that's coming into your eyes. So the remembered image is dimmer than the actual
yes.
ocular image. Now, the remote viewing image, you get all the other senses working with remote viewing as well, but the image is dimmer still than the remembered image. It's foggier. It's fuzzier.
It's,
and what you're doing when you're remote viewing is you're shifting your awareness, even though your eyes are open.
All right.
Shifting your awareness away from the physical ocular image, away from the remembered images, onto this remote viewing.
I understand. Doctor, we've got to pause right here. We're at the bottom of the hour. Stay right there. Dr. Courtney Brown is my guest, and we'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
My guest is Dr. Courtney Brown, Professor Brown from Emory University. He leads a team of remote viewers. You'd be well advised to listen closely, because maybe you too can take a cosmic voyage, and I suspect the answer to that is yes.
Listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Welcome back to the program. I really am able to grasp so far where we have been. To look at an object in front of you, picture the pencil. Which I can easily do, and that is as if it is from our hard drive. We have dredged this from our memory, but that is not remote viewing, is it?
No, that's remembering an image from the past, and it's as if there are three different projectors in our own brain, and that the three are the projector that gets images from the eyes, another projector with a lower luminosity, a dimmer bulb,
right,
that gets images from the memory,
right,
and then a third projector with the dimmest bulb and probably the foggiest lens, and that is the one that gets things from what we call the subspace side of ourselves. Now, I want to say something that's very important, and most of your listeners are going to really want to key in on this. You know, there's been a lot of complaints over the decades about wasted military spending.
Yes.
About how the military spent, there's so much money for a hammer, so much money for a toilet seat, or whatever. But I want to tell you that the military, the U.S. Army, the Defense Intelligence Agency, not the CIA, the DIA, every branch of the government has its own spies. Even the IRS has its own spies. But the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, the Pentagon, invested over a couple decades only $20 million at Stanford Research Institute, now called SRI International. $20 million is pocket change as far as the Pentagon is concerned.
Sure.
And for only $20 million, they developed, over a couple decades, these protocols of remote viewing. And let me tell you that if you have no other reason for wanting these protocols around than this, listen here. What the scientists did at Stanford Research Institute, at SRI International, one of the most prestigious defense scientific think tanks, laboratories on the planet Earth, What they did is give the world absolute positive proof, certifiable positive proof in laboratory conditions of the existence of the human soul. Because you see, remote viewing is not possible in the absence of a soul. Because you see, you don't physically go to any of these places, but you can describe these things with extraordinarily accuracy across time, space, anywhere on the planet or beyond. Exact descriptions down to the most incredible details. And what you must understand is that the remote viewing itself, when you're doing that, we call that other side of ourselves, that is human, this the soul side, the subspace aspect, and that is the component of yourself, the essential you that
okay,
does not go away, that you're using when you're remote viewing, and it's that component that is projecting onto the physical brain that foggier, fuzzier image.
Got you.
That you're using.
Got you, but I'm still not clear. In other words, suppose I were to say to you, what you're talking about, I firmly believe, does exist. I believe you can do it. It can be done. People can be trained to do it. But suppose I were to argue with you and say it does not establish scientifically the existence of the soul. It establishes scientifically the ability of the brain to accomplish things that we have long forgotten.
Well, you see, the brain is an electrochemical physical apparatus.
Right.
Under the normal laws of 3+1 dimensional physics, it is not possible for anything electrochemical physical to do what it does with regard to remote viewing. There has to be another component, another aspect, not yet completely understood by the science of today. And in scientific terms, what you'd say is there is a hypothesis. And a hypothesis is a statement that you want to see if it works out.
Yes.
And the hypothesis is, if there is a soul that is fundamentally non-physical, but exists as real as the hand, as the foot, as anything else,
yes,
if there is a soul that is fundamentally non-physical, then it should be able to do things such as know things, perceive things that the physical body cannot do. And so you give it a test. You develop and use these remote viewing procedures, and in fact you find out that you have to reject the null hypothesis, which is that there is no soul. And you have to accept the alternative hypothesis that there is, because you in fact are able to do that which the physical body cannot do.
Well,
that's the nature of the hypothesis testing. If you're wondering about that, I have to say that that's what all of science is out there doing. They're doing these hypotheses. They say, if this exists, then you must be able to do this X, Y, or Z with it. And that's how we build our airplanes. That's how we build our skyscrapers, our bridges. All the realm of physics, all the realm of science is built up on establishing hypotheses. And these hypotheses are what we use to fundamentally come up with what we call our laws. The laws of subspace were in our, what we might call our state of genesis of understanding. We don't understand all of the physics of the soul. We don't understand all of the physics of the subspace side of life, the spiritual side of life. But there is nothing in any spiritual text where God has forbidden us to ever investigate the physics of spirituality or the physics of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And we're just at that beginning. So part of your question I've answered, Art. The rest of the question is to be answered not by myself, but to be answered by physicists, other scientists, as the decades go on, as we unravel every little small piece of the physics of the soul. But we know at this point, with absolute certifiable factual understanding, that there is more to us than just a physical body, because in fact remote viewing would be impossible without that other aspect of ourselves.
Does remote viewing at any point establish truly the immortality of the soul itself?
Well, just the fact of being able to remote view does not do that.
Right, that's right.
Having remote viewed both myself and having, you know, we've had over 30 students here at the Farsight Institute. That's FARSIGHT, like seeing far,
uh-huh,
one word.
Yes.
Yes. We've had over 30 students, and the military itself trained 19 remote viewers. Having had these remote viewers operational, we now know that, in fact, we've perceived all sorts of things that it's clear as could be that we do not die. It's not just the existence of the ability to remote view and to train it. It's the fact that we have, once gotten that ability, trained ourselves, used it to perceive before our own birth, after our physical death. We have perceived things that deeply go into the realm of the non-physical. Mind you, that everything that I've talked about with remote viewing was originally developed, and in training is always done with verifiable targets, physical, hard
targets
that you can verify. So when you use these exact same procedures that you get extraordinarily accurate, great accuracy with, on the more difficult targets, more esoteric targets, things dealing with the realm of life after death and so on, we get very, very good, reliable types of information, because using those same procedures that are sufficiently accurate to risk men and women's lives on the battlefield for, you can then use those procedures to answer other questions
yes.
that are more global.
All right, before we leave the nature of the soul, I want to ask you about the nature of the soul. Obviously, you have far sight with regard to the nature of the soul. So, Doctor, do we come back? Are we reincarnated?
We have found that there is no police force out there that would stop a personality, a subspace being, a soul, from coming back in physical life if he or she so wished. We have found that, in fact, many people have had. We have checked it out. We have remote viewed under totally blind conditions, and I'll explain that later on in the show.
All right.
Under totally laboratory-type conditions, we have found out that, in fact, people have existed before. We have found out that they have existed in physical form many times. You see, the physical body, we now know, is just a vehicle. It's like your car. And after a certain number of years, it wears out and it drops off. But the driver is still there. The driver, the personality, the subspace being, you may call it the soul, is there before the physical body is turned on, and it's there after the physical body decays and drops off. But we absolutely know that the body is just something we live within. We are occupying it. And the genetics of the body is absolutely spectacularly fascinating, because
it is.
Our genetics are so structured that in our particular genetic mix, a lot of ETs, we now know, do not have genetic mixes like ours. Our particular genetic mix makes us almost totally blind to the flavor of the soul, to the flavor, to the memory of who we were, who we are, in fact, or where we came from. In fact, in ET circles, we have found out that we are often referenced as a species, not derisively, not mockingly, but with admiration. We are often called the masters of limitation, because we have a set of genes that develop into bodies that make us almost blind to whatever came before and whatever comes after. And we don't see past time. We don't see past our physical bodies, our physical experience. And that's because of the genetic structure we have. Other ETs have different genetic mixes and, in fact, don't have those problems at all. Now, you may say, well, that's a problem with us. That needs to be fixed.
Doesn't it mean we're more or less cosmic dummies?
Well, you could say that, but you see, before we were physically born, we knew everything, and after we die, we know everything once again. What would be the purpose of wanting to come into these very limited physical bodies? Well, the purpose is, we now know from remote viewing data that goes back a long time, we now know that what happens is, when you come into physical form like this, by forgetting everything that you've done before, you basically, as far as you're concerned, have 100 years approximately, a little less, a little more, whatever, however long you live,
right,
to pack everything you possibly can imagine into that short period of time, every experience you can possibly think of, to make love one more time, to get another car, get another job, to go to the beach one more time, to write one more book, to do one more thing. The point is, you develop your personality more in one lifetime as a physical human, because you run the race of time. for those few short years that you're alive, you do everything you can.
Otherwise, we would be like cosmic welfare recipients sitting around not concerned about packing anything into this life at all.
We have found out that in the subspace side of life, since you don't die, there's no real pressure to develop, and development occurs more slowly.
Fascinating.
This is an acceleration school that we live in. And, in fact, I might mention that we have remote viewed a few other species. And, in fact, when you remote view Adam and Eve right now, of course, they're not dead. They're not dead any more than they were when they were Project ET genetic and cultural uplift managers of their project here. But when you remote view them, it's an interesting flavor that is sometimes perceived. Some remote viewers don't perceive that much of a change in Adam and Eve when they were back here on Earth long ago and where they are now. And they have a different genetic mix, much more transparent across the subspace divide. And so they knew from the get-go that they were composite beings, two things put together, physical and subspace. And when I did the remote viewing on them, I sort of said, boy, someone needs to put a burr under their saddle. They've not done much in all these thousands of years. So that's what the advantages of being a human is. By cutting yourself off from the past for these short years, you put yourself through the juggernaut of trying to evolve quickly, and when you're done, you know, I must say that we have found out, this was done not only through remote viewing studies, but also at the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia, that the institute developed by Robert Monroe.
I was honored to interview Robert Monroe before he died.
He's a great being, and when at the Monroe Institute, they have found out using different technology, but technology that has also been extensively used by the U.S. military, that when people graduate from the human school, from the human experience, when they go on and they finally have had enough, they are extremely well respected out there. Basically, when it's one of these situations, you find someone that no longer comes back into human form, no longer needs the experience, goes on and does other bigger, better things. I mean, infinity is a long time to be alive, so they have to keep on doing things. But when other beings interact with someone who's graduated from the human experience, the word has it that they're incredibly impressed. It's sort of like you'd bump into them and say, wow, you're a very impressive person. Where'd you come from? And the person would say, well, I'm just so-and-so, but I used to be a human. I don't do that anymore. And the other person would say, a human? You mean you graduated from the human stuff? I mean, you became basically self-realized while you were a human. You became aware of who you were inside the human limited form. And the person would say, yeah, that's what I did. And then the other person would say, well, now, wait a sec. This is, like, amazing. Like, start in the beginning. We have to know everything about how'd you do this. You were born, all right? What happened?
It's like a monkey can suddenly talk.
Yeah, it's a very impressive thing when someone graduates from the human experience. That's what Bob Monroe and their institute have found out extensively. And we've
fairly rare occurrence.
Pardon me?
Fairly rare occurrence.
It doesn't happen as much as it will happen in the future, because when you are in such a limited physical body that is so cut off from who you were, who you are, it really is tough to fight through it. And a lot of specialized procedures are often used to accelerate that process. Remote viewing is one of them. The Monroe Institute offers a variety of others. And in my book, Cosmic Voyage, I also talk about other procedures, meditation procedures that are very compatible in a mechanical sense, non-belief-oriented sense, such as TM, the TM Cities program, which are oriented around literally just that concept of self-realization. Understand, self-realization is simply one thing. It's a very simple thing. It simply means that a person, while in physical form, became experientially aware of their other side, the soul, of the subspace side, as much as they're aware of their hands and their feet.
Okay, doctor, it's like
aware of the other side.
Yes, it's like you're talking about a sort of a cosmic speed course.
That's what the human experience basically is.
Yes, indeed. But I'm in terms of rising beyond or even approaching graduation, you're speeding these souls, these people, toward that end. And have you ever been concerned that you are indulging an unnatural process?
No, we're learning, and it's not unnatural at all, because we're not doing anything that's unnatural, other than learning in the remote viewing sense, to shift the awareness to something that is already there, something that has already been there since the beginning of time. It's just a flavor of information, a sense of data that is coming across that is mostly ignored except in those intuitive moments. For example, if a woman with children, any mother will tell you that if something's wrong with her kids, I mean seriously wrong with one of her children, she'll know it in
she'll
her heart.
Know it. Yes.
She'll will have no ambiguity, something's wrong. Or if something's wrong with a person's spouse, the other person often knows it in the heart, something's going on. And what that is the subspace side of life, the soul, the subspace being, that aspect, is picking up remote viewing in a sense, and in a very crude way, bludgeoning through all the electrochemical apparatus that's genetically programmed, bludgeoning through that awareness into the physical electrochemical brain so that it comes through, finally, that something's wrong, and we pick it up as an intuition. What remote viewing is, scientific remote viewing, the version that we use here at the Farsight Institute, is a way of writing down those intuitions in a scientifically controlled fashion.
Disciplined?
So to get the accuracy up.
Disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a good word, wouldn't it, for that? In other words, a disciplined intuition.
That's a good way of writing. That's a good way of talking about it. You might also add to it a discipline with a involved set of mechanical procedures. So it's not that you simply have to be disciplined like an army sergeant, but you're following a set of procedures. We know how we've got the bugs worked out of these procedures. In fact, the procedures that we now use at the Farsight Institute, scientific remote viewing, are much more evolved than the early military version. Everything changes as it proceeds, and I'm a scientist more than anything else.
Well, the only thing I was concerned about with your understanding of the nature of the soul is that, in essence, you're taking, say, a 12-year-old prodigy and graduating that 12-year-old from college and thrusting the 12-year-old out into the world from a soul point of view, sort of, and that some of your subjects are missing what they should have gone through. Now, think about that for a moment. We'll break here at the top of the hour. Relax. We'll be right back. This is radio. We've got lots of time. Dr. Courtney Brown, Professor Brown, my guest. We'll be right back.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Networks presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Good evening. Actually, good morning for most of you across the nation. Evening in Alaska and Hawaii yet. My guest is Professor Courtney Brown from Emory University. He leads a team of remote viewers. Remote viewing is a mental procedure that enables a person to extract accurate, descriptive information from distant locations. Remote viewing also works across time, in the sense that a remote viewer can extract information from the past, present, or future. Scientific remote viewing refers to a set of protocols that are a modernized version of a technique developed and used by the U.S. military in the 1980s and 90s for espionage. These protocols allow any normal, well-balanced individual to remote view with tremendous precision scientific studies using multiple remote viewers employing these protocols can yield results that approach 100% accuracy consistently. Scientific remote viewing has several distinct stages. Each one brings the remote viewer into closer contact with a target. A target is the location, person, or event about which information is desired. In each stage, different types of information are extracted about the target, and the overall result is typically a complete set of descriptive information, including sketches. In a moment, Professor Brown once again. I don't have to tell you what's happening to telecommunications. It's going nuts. And by the way, on our end of it, don't forget we've got the double helix crop circle on my webpage, as well as a connection to Dr. Brown's webpage. Just simply go up to www.artbell.com. That's www.artbell.com. That's just one part of telecommunications.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Back now to Professor Brown, who happens to be in the city now opening the Olympics, Atlanta. Dr. Brown, you're back on the air. We talked about remote viewing, the nature of the soul, and the last question I recall asking is, are you certain that you are not, in effect, taking people who are supposed to go through more of these limited life experiences and, in effect, graduating them early?
Well, that's an extraordinarily important question. Two parts to the answer, both short. First of all, we are aware now that most people don't have a few life experiences, but many, many lifetimes or life experiences, and that school is not bad. We all go to school. We shouldn't be superstitious about learning. Opening one's eyes does not hurt us. But with that in mind, let me say that I'm going to say now something that's my opinion. All things are, of course, that I'm saying are my opinion. But in this particular thing, I want to emphasize that this is my opinion and that the military remote viewers, as much as I love them all, they've all had their moments of genius and their contribution to this entire field. Every single one of them has been great. But in my opinion, the military remote viewers were not well served by the exact method of training and procedures that they went through, because they learned remote viewing in the absence of a broader course in the growth in consciousness. It started out as a parlor trick. It ended up as an espionage tool. But before, in my years of exposure to these people, I have yet to find one that spoke to me in terms of them understanding what they were actually doing when they were remote viewing, that they were using their soul to extract the data. They, at least in conversations with me, never put the two together and made an understanding that this has a soul or a subspace aspect connection. It was always a strange new power.
That actually makes sense. And I would expect that's the way the military would approach it. They wouldn't want to get into or even care about and probably would shy away from any discussion of what might seem to be a religious nature.
But the result is, we strip away religion from this discussion and just say, if it can happen, it's in the realm of science. And what we have to say is that in my personal view, that some of the military people were affected in a way that was not always the best, which is regard to the perception was that I can do this now. It's an ability. I am different from, better than, capable of doing something other people can't. And then you know, the normal process of competition within them, egos growing, things like that. This is not a fault of a personality, but the process itself was not well explained to them. And it's partly the result simply of the fact that we were new in learning the procedures and understanding the ability in the beginning, and these things were normal. But as a consequence of my personal interactions with these people, that I have restructured the training program completely at the Farsight Institute. Not only have we modernized the actual remote viewing procedures, but we also embed the training with lectures, discussions, presentations, for example, with regard to other approaches to consciousness, so that we encourage people not just to learn how to remote view with great accuracy, but to also pursue growth in consciousness that leads them in the direction of healthy self-realization. In that regard, we have a very close and supportive relationship with the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia, where they use a different type of technology but is oriented towards self-realization. And we also support the use of TM, Transcendental Meditation, and the TM Cities program, the advanced version of that, which is a mechanical approach. We found it to be very compatible with scientific remote viewing. In fact,
if I may, let me stop you for a second. You, before we get away from the military aspect,
right?
I know that you don't want to discuss other people, and I don't think we need to, but I did interview Major Ed Dames, who was involved in the military program, and is now out, has formed a company called SciTech. And what he said to me was very interesting. He said, when we were doing the military remote viewing, we were concentrating on very specific espionage-related military targets. It was very, very disciplined. But a funny thing happened along the way. We began to see some other things. For example, he said, we saw, looking into the future, we saw babies dying. Now, we didn't pay attention to it. It was seen, it was noted, and it was dismissed because it was not of interest to the military. And then he expanded on that after he left the military, and he has since gone back and done more work in that area. But would you expect that would be true, that a lot of the military people saw things that they simply dismissed, they simply erased as part of the discipline to get to the target they were after, yes?
Yeah. Well, actually, the story that you just said is very interesting, and it literally every single one of the military remote viewers have their special mark in history with regard to this whole thing. And the story that you just said is very interesting because that is exactly what occurred. Many things were happening in the sessions when they were doing it, and things were being observed that they didn't know how to place. For example, they would, for example, be trying to locate Abu Nidal, a terrorist.
Yes.
Or they would be going after the location of Muammar Gaddafi. Or they would be trying to do some type of operational thing with regard to Desert Storm. And in the process of doing all of this stuff, some of the remote viewers, many of the remote viewers, most perhaps, and although I do not have, you know, I myself was not in the unit. I was not in the military. I didn't have personal contact with every one of them, but perhaps all of the remote viewers did notice things sort of over their subspace shoulder, over the remote viewing shoulder.
Exactly.
Light beings, other things happening, things that were happening on the subspace side of life. And, in fact, they were not capable of dealing with that information, so they dismissed it.
The military didn't want them to deal with that.
They didn't want them. They didn't know how to deal with it. It didn't fit into the normal remote viewing itself didn't fit into the normal accepted paradigms. And certainly the stuff that they were getting didn't fit into the normal accepted paradigms. And one of the things that has happened with scientific remote viewing is that we have changed, at the Farsight Institute, we have changed some of the procedures, most of the language, making it more easily to teach, make it simpler. But on the same sense, we've expanded the procedures, and we've expanded the types of information that we get. So we explicitly, in our sessions, now have places for and recording We explicitly have procedures for recording the things that were dismissed by the early remote viewers. All of the subspace activity, for example, we have explicit places for that information to be recorded. We don't dismiss it anymore. I might say, just as a vignette on that interesting topic that you raised, is that there was a... I don't really want to talk about personalities, but there's one personality I will mention. There was a brilliant general, two-star major general, Albert Stubblebine, who was in charge of the whole area under which the remote viewing unit was assigned.
Okay.
In INSCOM. And the problem with General Stubblebine from a job perspective was that he was doing his job perhaps a little bit too well. And
Meaning what?
Well, in the sense that he ran into a lot of problems within the military when his remote viewing team started to come up with data, results. And he, as the good general, started to report it. And some of the data dealt with some of this information that was being discarded, some of this being not used, no place for it, not within the right paradigms. And some of the military higher-ups looked at General Stubblebine with not complete favor, and he ran into some some professional problems, really due to no fault of himself. The information he was carrying was a little bit too different for a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, within any institution, there are types of information that are accepted within that institution. That is not just the military, but any institution. And some of the remote viewing data absolutely stretched the military's levels to its very edge.
I mean, if you were trying to figure out where Saddam Hussein was, and you had a team concentrating on that, and somebody came and talked to you about Adam and Eve...
Yeah, or while you were remote viewing Saddam Hussein, you saw a light being over your shoulder.
That's
observing it.
That's right.
They think you are nuts.
That's right.
But the reality is, life is more complicated than we thought with our simple, narrow, limited, three-dimensional plus one time expectations.
Believe me, military careers can slow to a crawl over things like that.
Yeah, and General Stubblebine was one of those people who took a little bit of flack and was, you know, all of these people, every one of them, had their great moments in the history of this development.
Well, that would be true and probably suffered greatly for it, like most founding groups or fathers.
Well stated.
Yeah. So now you've got a private organization. Farsight Institute is private, is it?
Right. Now, what I did was I had, when I wrote Cosmic Voyage, A Scientific Discovery of Extraterrestrials Visiting Earth, that's Dutton. It's under the Dutton label. It's a Penguin book. When I wrote that, I was originally going to treat this just as any other book. The only difference between my use of remote viewing and the military's was that instead of looking for terrorists or bombing targets or whatever,
yes,
I used those same procedures but aimed them up towards the extraterrestrials, the ET, the UFO phenomena, the Enigma. And I focused just basically on that. But when I did it, I had the expectation, as controversial as the book would be, I knew it, I had the expectation that I'd walk away from it and start my next book right after that, just like all academics do. We write one book, we finish it, we go on to our next project. But at the very last stages of right before the book went into production, it had gone through all of its editorial stuff, it had gone through everything, I had a conference call with my editor and the lawyers, the best legal minds available in New York on literary matters.
I'll bet.
And they are the lawyers of Penguin, Hired Guns.
Sure.
And there was a conference call. And they said, Dr. Brown, we have one last thing. You described to us your procedure, what you went through to get training from some of these military guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there aren't many of them out there. And, you know, what you had to go through was something that may be difficult for a lot of people to go through in terms of finding them and getting the things going, at least at the time that I was doing this.
Right.
It was very difficult for me to finally get the training, but I finally got it. And they said, and the people that are available for training don't do it the way you would suggest it to be done. Now, the whole thing about science is replicability. That's the fundamental characteristic of science. If you've got something going on in a laboratory, you've got to be able to replicate it elsewhere under the exact type of conditions. So they said, Dr. Brown, we need an institute. There's got to be an institute for doing this stuff the way you think it should be done. That's the whole claim. I mean, we're going to put ourselves, this is a major press, Penguin, we're going to put ourselves on the line and push this book, and don't you think we need an institute? And that was the lawyers saying this. And then I said, well, an institute, but I don't have an institute. I just do my research and I go on to my next book.
Yes.
And then there was this long, pregnant pause, and my editor chimed in and said, boy, we'd sure like to sign off on this book today, Dr. Brown. And I said, oh, is that it? So the implication was that if I didn't set up an institute, there'd be... So I basically just squeaked out, okay, I'll do it. But, you know, I realized what that would mean. That'd mean hiring secretaries. I mean, that talks about organizations. But I did it, and I'm glad it actually happened that way. So we now have an institute, a regular, full-fledged academic institute where we teach people, anyone, who is interested, from scientists to reporters to just plain interested people, how to do the most modernized form of the originally military-derived remote viewing protocols. And we have regular classes. We've had a variety of classes. We've trained so far 31 remote viewers. And I must say that 28 of these remote viewers have given us written permission to post their results up, or parts of their results up, the results that are understandable and can be presented easily on the Internet, to post these results up on the Internet. And to date, I've got we've got 11 results, partial results, posted up on the Internet. So people that go to your webpage and then snap over to the Farsight Institute's webpage, you mentioned it as my webpage.
Yes.
People that go over to my webpage, they can go to a section called the Students' Corner, and they can see 11 results, and all done under totally blind conditions, which is what we use at the Farsight Institute. And Art, I hope you ask me one time what that actually means, because that's very important. Your viewers are going to want to know, what is this? How do we know this really works? To know that, you have to know what blind conditions is all about.
Doctor, you have viewers. I have listeners.
Okay. I'll do it then. Here, what blind conditions is? At the Farsight Institute, we only use blind conditions. Now, what that means is, now get this, we have a target we want to send someone to perceive, to accurately describe in minute detail, say, the Great Wall of China, or the Eiffel Tower, or the assassination of J.F. Kennedy, anything that you can think of we can go to. And we have that target, but we don't want to tell the viewer what the target is.
You don't?
No, because then the viewer's mind, the conscious mind, is going to be all activated, and everything in memory is going to start flooding out, and they'll start saying, oh, I remember what this is. And so it'll be more difficult for the remote viewer. So what we want to do is to give them the identification of the target without telling them what the target is. So what we use is 2 4-digit random numbers.
Wow.
The reason is these numbers come from a random number table or from a computer program that we use.
All right, Doctor, we must, this is network and we must break here. So
I'll describe it right after the break.
That's good. Stay right there. Professor Courtney Brown, author of Cosmic Voyage, is my guest. Remote viewing, the topic. We'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1996.
My guest is Dr. Courtney Brown, a tenured Ph.D. professor at Emory University. He runs the Farsight Institute, a group of remote viewers. It is a fascinating topic, and we're going to get back to it in just a moment.
Now, we take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Back now to Professor Brown. Professor, if you had not been a tenured PhD at Emory, after Cosmic Voyage was published, would they have blown you out of there like a bad dream?
Well, that possibly could have happened. But, you know, to give a good story about this, John Mack,
yes,
the tenured professor of psychiatry at Harvard, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, founder of his department of psychiatry in Harvard Medical School. When he came out a couple years back, year and a half ago actually, about 2 years back, with his book Abduction, which was about the basically one species of ETs called Greys.
Yes.
Fascinating book. When he came out with that, Harvard went through an academic inquisition, no less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unheard of these times, where basically they dragged him through approximately 40 closed-door hearings, lawyers-only type things, where they were trying basically, no holds barred, to get him removed.
That's right.
Now,
actually, it was a very close call.
It was a very close call, and after a year and a half of closed-door meetings, and really nip and tuck as far as John Mack was concerned, Pulitzer Prize-winning author or not, he almost lost his job, and what finally happened after a year and a half, the dean finally put closure on it and said, I guess this is an academic freedom issue, and, just closed the door on it and said, let's not hear anything more about this. John Mack can do whatever he wants. But by doing that, John Mack actually set out a principle for all universities, because by doing that, he forced Harvard to make a statement saying that people studying these high advanced level subjects of consciousness and extraterrestrials, ETs, UFOs, that this is legitimate within the realm of scientific inquiry. By forcing Harvard to do it, he saved the careers of an awful lot of other scientists, because no other university is going to do something that Harvard finally, at long last, decided not to do. Now, understand, Harvard is not known for its innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Harvard basically hires people that have done their creative work, and they are really, often their creative work has been elsewhere, and then Harvard hires them after they become, very big.
Very conservative.
And in that sense, Harvard is very conservative,
yes.
And they're really not the bastion of creativity and innovation as much as they are the defense of the orthodoxy, and they have a prestige to defend. And the harder they come, the higher they come, the harder they fall.
That's right. All right. Well, what about
Emory? Harvard, it's a little like that.
What about Emory? Have you run into any of that?
I've run into no problems with Emory.
No problems.
I don't know how much of it is because of Emory's long-standing commitment to academic freedom, which really is there, and how much of it is due to the fact that my book came out right after John Mack forced Harvard to make that decision.
So
it was helped by a variety of different
routes. All right, let us return now to remote viewing. You were telling us that in order to ensure that there's not a lot of false information flying about in the brains of these viewers, they are assigned targets by numbers. Now, I can't understand that.
Okay.
How would a series, so make me understand.
Okay, that's fine. Well, this is what's called blind conditions. What we have is, we have a target, say the Great Wall of China, the Eiffel Tower, the assassination of JFK,
okay,
the St. Louis, whatever.
Yes.
And that's our target. That's what we want to get information about.
Gotcha.
Now, we don't tell the remote viewer that this is what the target is. What we do is we say, well, let's go to the computer program or to a table of random numbers and get 2 4-digit random numbers. Why 2 4-digit? Well, it goes back to the old military days, it's a tradition, where they thought coordinates were needed, geographical coordinates, latitude and longitude.
Okay.
So that's a leftover from those days, and we have two four-digit random numbers. But they're totally random. They mean nothing to the conscious mind. And on a piece of paper, right next to whatever the target may be, say, you know, Nagasaki destruction event,
right.
We put down those two four-digit random numbers. Now, we then go over to the remote viewer, and we say, here is the target. And we tell the remote viewer those two four-digit random numbers, say 7275-5131.
There is your target.
That target. And the remote viewer writes those two four-digit random numbers down.
Yes.
Now, that's all the remote viewer is given about the target. Now, the physical conscious mind, the electrochemical brain, has no way of knowing what those numbers mean.
For sure.
That they mean the destruction of Nagasaki or Martians, present survivors, E.T.'s graves, President Clinton in the Oval Office,
gotcha.
Archer St. Louis, whatever it may be, has no knowledge of what those numbers mean. But the subspace component of the remote viewer, you might call it the soul, or some people call it the unconscious, we have found that that other part of ourselves, the essential being of ourselves, has instant awareness of all things, including what those numbers represent. And what we do is we send the remote viewer through the set of procedures, mechanical procedures, on those numbers, beginning with those numbers, and the information that comes across through the soul, through the subspace aspect,
yes.
projected onto the brain, dimmer, foggier, fuzzier, but nonetheless the remote viewers are trained to recognize it and to write it down. That information is written down, and what we do at the end of the session is we have a complete description of what that target is, and the remote viewer was never told what the target was. And then at the end of the session, after all the information is down on the piece of paper, an indelible ink, can't be erased, after all the information is down, the remote viewer says, "Phew, now that that's over, what was that?" And we tell them.
All right.
That was, you know, whatever
the
target was. All
right, now let us get to the scientific repeatability aspect of it. Can you take remote viewer A and assign them target A in one room, and remote viewer B, C, D, and E in separate rooms, assigning them the same target and establish roughly the same report?
That's exactly what we do, except we don't do it with two. At the Farsight Institute, we typically do it with eight students at a time,
eight.
All separated so they can't see each other working. They're all separated physically with barriers. But the point is, we teach them the procedures, and then we give a target, and then all eight work on the target in
right.
silence,
right.
in silence, all separated. They can't see each other.
Right.
And then at the end of the session, when we say, put your pens down, we then collect everybody's session up, and that one at a time, we put them on a table, and everybody looks at everybody else's session. You can often hear pin drops when they look, and they say, you know, you can always discard your own work. They say, you can say, I must have done that by chance. How could I have done that? But when you see eight other people in the same room coming up with the same information, it's just awe-inspiring.
Give me the numbers. With regard to your research so far, what percentage of accuracy can you repeatably demonstrate?
Well, it varies as you get better at it. So
sure,
when you first
course.
Start it, but I should say this, to start with, we have not had a single person in our institute of 32 that have come through that have not been able to learn it and not been able to do it. Every single one has
Can't
been able
it.
To do it. We know how to work this now. We've got all the bugs worked out of this. Secondly, information at the end of training is as good as the military people ever were. But the requirement is that the people at the end of training have a professional monitor, someone to remind them of which procedure comes next so they make sure that no mistakes are made. After the initial week intensive training that we give, we have another course called Farsight Seer, which is the professionalization course, where even that limitation is removed because they become monitors themselves. They become experts. They become professionals. And then we even have a teacher training course, and we're actively developing a large group of teachers. So the point is that a professional, someone who's gone through the introductory course as well as the professionalization course, those people, and if they do everything that we suggest, especially, you know, don't do anything, don't do anything wrong, we do not have a single unexplained missing of a target, in the sense that as long as nothing was physically done wrong, like a blunder, as might be done in, say, the introductory parts of training, as long as there's no physical blunder, no gross mistake in the execution of the procedures, which is very rare among professionals, we don't have a single case of anyone completely missing a target. We know how this thing works.
So you're saying repeatably?
Absolutely. Replicability is the bottom line.
100% of the time.
Well, what we're saying is the following. Like when you ride a bicycle, you fall down in the beginning. So you can you say, well, is that bicycle going to be stable 100% of the time? Well, in the beginning you fall down. But, you know, look at the Olympic bicyclists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very rare day on, it's a very rare moon whenever they fall down off a bicycle.
That's right.
You know, they're good at it. So the point is, when people do everything that we say that we have, that that we tell them to do, you know, it may be in the future that we'll find out that, you know, certain percentages of the targets don't work very well. But the reality is, when people become professional using this stuff, we don't, and they don't, and there's no gross mistakes being made in the procedures, we don't have a single case yet where people have completely gone off target.
That's quite a claim.
So it's, you know, we really understand it. And I must say that I am a scientist, and all science evolves. So that what we know now is an improvement over what was going on in the original military program, and what will go on in 10 years and in 20 years will be an improvement on what we do now. So science is constantly evolving. There is no original perfect set of procedures that's good for the rest of time. Everything evolves, and that's why we look at this at the Farsight Institute as a real academic institute where research is going on and where we constantly innovate and do things. By the way, I should also mention that we have a medical course that we anticipate to offer in the beginning of 1997, and the procedures are being used very accurately and productively in hospital settings today. And, you know, you never do it if somebody has broken a leg. If it's a broken leg, you just fix it.
Diagnostics?
But for very complicated diagnostics where you don't have the foggiest reason, idea of what to do next, doctors can use it and actually come up with very, very important information about what's wrong with people.
This is really remarkable. All right, let me take you in a sort of a side direction for just one moment.
Oh, sure.
Having established what you can do scientifically, and I think you have established that, let me ask you about ethics a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
If I were not an ethical person, and I came to you and I went through your course, and I went all the way through your course and became very good at what I do, could I not, with my talent, attain great power, great riches, great everything? In other words, use this ability for personal gain. Must I be ethical with it, or is the very process itself driven to an ethical boundary, or stays within an ethical boundary? You see what I'm trying to ask,
right?
I'm sure.
The point is that we truly live in a free will universe, and the remote viewing procedures are mechanical. They are not belief-oriented, so anything is possible, including what you just suggested. With that said, however, I want to state that at the Farsight Institute, we take particular efforts, very great efforts, to explain remote viewing in the realm of larger growth unconsciousness. For example, we now know that it is literally the subspace component of all of us, the subspace side of us, of our composite nature, two things put together, our soul, that actually does the perception. And if you look back of it, what did the military use it for? Now, this is not a criticism. This is just, this was their business, and they had to do it this way. But what did they do it for?
Doctor, the same sort of thing that I'm going to ask you about right now, bringing it back down to ground level. I go through your course.
Right.
I go to work for some microchip company.
Right.
I say, look, guys, how would you like to have the latest research two or three years ahead of what you're doing, going on in Tokyo right now. Oh, I can give it to you. I can give it to you. $500,000, $1 million, whatever it is, I can give you this technology.
That's already going on. There is a remote viewer that a military remote viewer, Joe McMonagle, who's out at the, who can be, he often shows up in classes at the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia. He's a natural psychic. He's not trained. He's a natural psychic, and he has an accuracy rate of about 80%. But he works for contracts for private companies all the time, and there are a significant number of patents out there where people hire him and some other remote viewers for technology transfer, for,
yes,
both from off planet and from the future. And patents are, you know, people are making money on patents with regard to this stuff. There's another professor, such as myself, and this is a full professor and in a very prestigious, one of the most prestigious engineering universities, colleges in the country, that is getting patent after patent after patent using a remote viewer. And he has actually tried to show some of his colleagues how they're getting the information. The colleagues just don't want to listen. They just say, just take your patents. I don't want to know how you get it. But, you know, the point is that he, with the remote viewer, has found an ET library, believe it or not, a library, and they're works on the level of consciousness, and they're just tapping into it.
All right, we're going to certainly get to that. But again, the ethics. Now, if I go to a company and I say, "Look, guys, I can steal the latest for you." The key word there is steal, theft. It is theft. If you're able to remote view somebody else's technology, then assume it for your own. That, doctor, is theft.
Yeah. Well, you understand that this level of secrecy that you're talking about being broken only exists within the limitations of our genetic makeup. Once you break that, there are no secrets anymore.
Well,
I'll give you an example.
At that plane, yes, but here on Earth, doctor,
Now we've broken it. Now on Earth, in the physical level, we're no longer limited by this anymore. We can remote view anything. So all those secrets are no longer secrets.
No more secrets.
Let me give you an example. In my book, Cosmic Voyage, there's a chapter. I was monitored by a former retired high-ranking member of the military during the entire process of writing this book, of doing the research. And this monitor sent me under completely blind conditions into the White House, into the Oval Office.
Oh, really?
And I described that session. And it took 25 minutes for me to go through the procedures. And finally, I said to the monitor, I'm sorry, but the only thing I'm getting is I'm in a room, it's round, and I'm standing in front of the president. President Clinton is here. What am I supposed to do now? And at that point, the monitor ended the session, because that indeed was the target. And he told me afterwards, that's the target, let's end the session. And that took 25 minutes. And then the monitor said, yeah, we could have done some interesting things. I could have sent you into the mind of the president, but, you know, being former military types, we still have some respect for the commander-in-chief. But the reality is, he could have sent me right into the mind of the president to extract any information that was necessary.
Seems to me, doctor, if you can really do that, you could be killed for that.
Well, no, it's not because of me, you see. We're teaching people how to do this now. So
you could be killed. You could be killed for that.
What's that?
I said you could be killed for that.
Well, I have a respect for our president as well, so I don't do things like that.
But maybe not all your students will.
Well, actually, to be quite honest, we do teach them how to enter the minds of people in training. That's part of the training process.
Oh,
it's called a deep mind probe. And I just had a student the other day.
No Fourth Amendment problems here, eh?
Well, we have to we have to understand science is changing. And you know, you could have said, in the old days, you could have said, well, when technology changes, does the rest of the world have to stop? But we now know that when technology changes, and remote viewing is a technology now, our physical realm has to adapt.
Hold it there. We're going to break, and we need one after all that. We'll be right back. Dr. Courtney Brown is my guest. Don't move.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
My guest is Professor Courtney Brown. He is a tenured PhD professor at Emory University. He has written a book called, isn't that terrible? It's Cosmic, is it Cosmic Journey? Is it Cosmic Voyage? It is a cosmic trip, that's for sure. And what we have done in the last 2 hours is to establish the scientific validity of remote viewing, the ability to look at a distant geographic location, the ability to look at a distant person or object, the ability to enter their mind, the ability to read into the future, see literally into the future or the past. And without going through all of the discussion of the past 2 hours, I will tell you, if you have been listening, you should be by now convinced of the scientific reality and viability of remote viewing. We have not yet talked about some of the targets that Dr. Brown has viewed. That part is coming up. I could not have done that, ladies and gentlemen, in my view, without having established the base, the scientific repeatable base of proof for the existence of remote viewing. Having done that, and I think having done that, we will indeed begin to ask about specific targets shortly. I want to remind everybody, just a quick note, we've got the double helix crop circle, a most remarkable thing to see, now on my webpage. In addition, you want to know more about remote viewing, if you want to know more about Dr. Courtney Brown and his work, go to my webpage, which is www.artbell.com, www.artbell.com. The latest crop circle formation up there as of tonight. The link to Dr. Brown up there as of last night and available to you on my webpage now.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Dr. Courtney has told us that under scientific conditions, it is possible to take 8 trained remote viewers, I said 8, in separate rooms, assigning them a target, not one that they know of, but a number that relates to a target, or more specifically, actually does not, and the 8 remote viewers will go to their target, report the information. Then these 8 will be gathered together. The notes, the information on the target will be identical. It can be done with trained pros to the point where it is or can achieve near 100% accuracy. That's scientific, it's repeatable, and I guess it's real. And it's kind of frightening, isn't it, Doctor, for the uninitiated?
Well, for the uninitiated, it can be a little bit new, and all new things are a little bit surprising. But I want to say just to help clarify something, that the results necessarily are not necessarily identical across remote viewers, and that is because the personality of each remote viewer is involved in what they particularly go for.
But isn't the goal to suppress as much of that?
That's right, but let me explain.
All right.
Every remote viewer goes to the site and gets aspects of the site that are clearly, unambiguously related to that site.
Right.
But not every remote viewer goes to the same aspect of the site. For example, if you're to target the blowing up of the 747
yes.
that happened a couple of days ago, then and you're to send 8 remote viewers there and figure it out what's going on, you may write the target in such a way that all 8 remote viewers, they'll all get an explosion. They'll all get people dying, lives, people falling out of the sky. They'll all get a jetliner blowing up or something like that, some aerial explosion. But some of them may, if the thing was a missile, for example, that blew it up, some of them may give you much more detail about the missile, whereas others won't even have any detail about the missile. If it was a bomb inside the airliner, some of the remote viewers might actually pick up how the bomb was actually placed in the jetliner, whereas other remote viewers wouldn't have gotten that particular information.
All right, well, that's
so
clear.
So there's the personality of each remote viewer gets different aspects. So
that's clear.
It's not that they're all carbon copies. Also, when we do things at the Farsight Institute, we sometimes put people in separate rooms, but we also have training where all 8 people are in the same room, but it's a very large room, and they're all separated by barriers, so they can't see each other. So, but nonetheless, your description is correct in the sense that right after that, they are separated from each other, and right
yes.
after that, they come together and review everybody's work. It's really quite a moving experience for everyone when they first start seeing this.
I brought up the subject of the ethics of it, and somebody sent me a fax here. It says, knowledge can't be owned. It's not theft. It's merely the universal database and access to it.
In fact, getting into some of our targets, ET-related targets, we have to understand that the big difference between us humans and advanced ETs is, as a rule, technologically as well as experientially, they are self-realized, the ETs. They have a complete understanding of the composite physical and
non-physical
side of life, and they have no secrets.
Yes, are you sure they are? Well, there are no, in your world, there are no secrets. There are no longer any secrets. That's a frightening prospect. Are you sure they are ETs? I know many have seen beings of light, different beings. How can you be sure these are really extraterrestrials in the very purest form of the meaning? They are living on or have been on other planets in other systems.
Good question. Mm-hmm. Art, there's no ambiguity about this. With the exact same procedures that are used to put men and women's lives at stake on the battlefield, and the military had a minimum 85% accuracy, 85% of the time. That was better, by the way, than some of their normal spy stuff. Because, you know, when you get physical spies out there, a lot of the physical spies are given disinformation. Not everything you get is correct.
Yes.
So the remote viewing data was very competitive, often superior, than the information they got from their regular, ordinary spies. So with that same level of accuracy on and above, we have used the same procedures to target the extraterrestrials. And one thing I want to tell you that you do not have to believe me, science is not a matter of belief. It's a matter of replicability under controlled scientific laboratory conditions. And we do not have just me as a remote viewer doing this. Besides the military folks, or the former military folks, we have 32 remote viewers at the Farsight Institute who have become very proficient at getting information from physical targets that are just normal, Eiffel Tower or whatever, using the same procedures on ET-related targets and getting very, very accurate results in the sense of comparability. Meaning, if someone goes to Mars and is supposed to be looking at something life-oriented around Mars or on Mars, you get all the same people describing the same thing using the exact same procedures. Now, if the procedures didn't work, we have no business committing men and women's lives on the field for this.
Sure.
The procedures do work.
All right, here's a hard question. Here's a hard question for you. I want to stop you. It is my understanding the military is now, or claims, that they have ended their a remote viewing project, correct?
That is correct.
Right. If it's so damn effective, then why have they done that? If it's better than human assets on the ground in many cases with regard to intelligence matters, why in the world would they end the project? Or is the answer they really have just ended the public knowledge of...
That last part is partially... There is still an operational capability within the military. There are people still in uniform who are remote viewers, and one, in fact, is a very high-ranking military officer. With that said, I must say that there are three different reasons for the elimination of the actual unit.
Let's hear them.
The first is that the generals themselves have their own traditional belief systems that the remote viewing stuff really goes right against. They're like anybody else.
Religious objection.
Yeah, all types of traditional belief systems,
all right.
Religious and stuff like that.
I can buy that.
And when you start bringing in the remote viewing stuff, you start challenging basically all belief systems because you're bringing in vastly new information.
Okay, I can buy that.
And so some of the generals have a difficult time with that. The second reason for it is that politically, remote viewing is not easy to do accept on the political popularity reason. What is the problem is that the American government,
in other words, getting money
for want a scandal.
Getting money for it, yeah, okay.
And they do not want a lot of people saying, oh, this is another way of throwing money down the drain, and the military is investing in psychics and
XYZ.
Yes,
okay.
And the government wants to avoid things like that because it takes too much time to explain it. You've been having me on for over 2 hours.
Right.
And people are basically just now getting it right. But in the normal news, you've got a 10-second, 30-second soundbite at most.
That's right.
And it's just too difficult to explain, and the government says, I just can't explain this.
Well, that's why I hate TV.
So, well, basically, that's the problem. So the government has eradicated these types of controversies. The third reason for this is that the government is now backpedaling a lot with regard to this program. They're acknowledging the existence of the unit, but they are very concerned about what happened to the members of the unit. The unit was supposed to be very highly classified.
And it's all broken out.
And it's everywhere. And
all right, but still, Doctor, I can't believe they'd stop it. Look, our CIA, bless their hearts, they've got the morals of an alley cat. And if they could get information about what's going on in Russia or China or wherever, I'm just absolutely certain they've still got a program going on. Maybe not the military one that you know, accounts for your beginnings. But
well, there is no training program going on. I know that. There is no training program going on right now within the military. Really, they're trying to distance themselves from what has occurred as the former, now retired, remote viewers. Are a number of them, not all of them. There were, 19 people that were trained by Ingo Swan, the original military group, and the military right now is trying to backpedal as fast as it can from some of the people that were in the unit that are now coming out publicly talking about it. Basically, we're talking about breaking security oaths. We're talking about coming out publicly, writing books, trying to make movies, things like that, on something that was one of the most highly classified projects ever.
Right.
And the government's not happy with that. And the military itself is not looking
well, then how
on
come,
all this information coming out from its trusted spies.
Then how come Ingalls and all the others, Major Dames, whoever, why are these guys still walking around? Why aren't they...
Well, to actually clamp down on all of these people, they have their own, they have a few internet outlets. One of them is almost become what you might consider the former military's homepage. you can get to it by going under Yahoo and looking under remote viewing. Just search remote viewing under Yahoo on the internet.
Right.
And you'll get two institutes. One is mine, the Farsight Institute. Actually, I can't just say it's mine anymore. It's so many people working with
right.
it. And the other is the controlled remote viewing homepage of one of the former military people.
Right.
And the whole history of the unit, all of its bumps and everything, its warts and everything, can be found there. And, the government's not very happy about that. In fact, the controlled remote viewing homepage of the retired unit was actually decimated once by a hacker that got into the internet site where it's housed, got through all the firewalls in one fell swoop, went to the homepage, eradicated it without eradicating anyone else's, so badly that it couldn't be rebuilt and had to be uploaded originally again.
Yeah, the internet may be the biggest enemy of government
secrecy.
Well,
you know, that's there. Anyway, they rebuilt the site, the actual homepage for that remote viewing homepage, and the next day it was eradicated again by the same hacker that went through yet more firewalls.
Mm.
And this time the hacker said, you know, I'll show you, and destroyed the actual internet server, the actual machine that the site was made on.
Wow.
And then the hacker so thoroughly destroyed, this is a high-level hacker that knows everything, so thoroughly destroyed the thing that the company had to actually go out and buy a new web server for all of its customers because the machine was destroyed. I mean, it was a total eradication.
That's amazing.
So, and, you know, a common run-of-the-mill teenage hacker can't do things like that. So the basic bottom line is that...
So the answer is they are after them.
Well, they haven't gone after the homepage again for that group that controls the remote viewing homepage.
Mm-hmm.
And the best information I've got so far is that they basically abandoned the attempt to go after anybody.
Doctor, two fast questions,
okay,
if I might.
Sure.
One, could ghosts, or what we think of as ghosts, actually be remote viewers?
Actually, that's they could be misperceived as remote viewers. The point is that ghosts are just people without physical bodies, and you know, a remote viewer, the consciousness, the presence of the remote viewer can be perceived by a very sensitive person. Normally, humans, 99% of the time plus, are not aware that you're remote viewing them.
No.
That is not the same with ETs. Most ETs, like Grays and others, they know from the get-go that you're going.
All right,
you're coming before you're even going there.
All right, we're just about to get to the ETs. But before we do, one last question, that is, what would happen, Doctor, if during a remote viewing session you died?
Well, what would happen if you had a heart attack or something like that?
Yeah, died.
Well, nothing would happen. It's not an out-of-body experience, so you're not departing the body anyway. What would happen if the person physically died is that their subspace aspect, just like any death, would disconnect from the physical body, and
snap.
They would look back at the physical body, sort of like in the Whoopi Goldberg movie Ghosts. Very
okay.
Much like that. No, quite literally, it's very much like that. We've seen that happen.
All right.
We look at a lot of deaths when we do remote viewing because a lot of interesting events have deaths in it.
Indeed. Dramatic, traumatic moments. All right,
Art, if I could just interject one thing. Just before the break, you made a comment that that might frighten some people, thinking that, you know, like, disaster is imminent. Should we start digging? And I want to say that I have no indication of anything like that. If anything, I have, you know, the indication that the changes that are going to happen,
yes,
are going to be gradual, and that, you know, the very near-term future for humans on this planet is, this is one of the most exciting times to be alive, as you'll see when we talk more about the ETs and so on.
Indeed, Doctor, but you did say our children's lifetime.
Yeah, the future that far out is very difficult. And again, I also mentioned that it was probabilistic, meaning that's the one that we see. But for reasons that we don't completely understand, it is possible for the timeline to change.
I understand.
I'm hoping for the best.
All right, look, we're going to talk about specific targets here shortly, Doctor. But you mentioned and teased a little bit, and I did ask you about it the other day. I don't pre-interview, but I talked to you for a few moments, and I couldn't resist asking about Flight 800.
Sure.
You have not yet targeted Flight 800,
no.
Have you?
No, we haven't. And one thing we do know about remote viewers is you can perceive virtually anything, but you only know what you've looked at. It's like a closet.
Sure.
Unless you've looked inside the closet, you simply don't know what's there. So with regard to Flight 800, it'll be a great target for the future, but we haven't assigned that to anyone yet.
Are you going to do that?
Oh, sure, when they least expect it. When they're absolutely convinced the next target will be the Eiffel Tower, that's when we'll snap it to them.
Just a quick answer, if you would.
Sure.
If you have a group targeting, say, Flight 800,
right,
would there be any other remote viewers out there that could know you're targeting, you know, could, in essence, understand that you're in the process of targeting something?
Well, That's a fascinating question.
And it requires a quick answer. Is the answer yes?
Yes, but the answer that I'll give right after the break is more fascinating than you can possibly imagine.
All right, that's a good teaser. Stay right there. We'll be right back. Doesn't this fit?
I see trees of green.
Listen carefully.
Red roses too. I see them blue. For me and you.
No more secrets, folks.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Is it now?
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
Clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky.
Presents Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
My guest is a tenured professor at Emory University, Dr. Courtney Brown. The subject, remote viewing. Back to it in a moment.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Back now to Dr. Brown. Doctor, continue, please.
Well, you just asked me if it is possible for another remote viewer to perceive, you know, a different remote viewer doing something.
And a targeting, yes.
A target. Now, there's two fascinating answers to this. The first is, when the U.S. found out that there was a Soviet psychic espionage unit in existence as well during the Cold War, the U.S. team was given the target, some members of it were given the target, of literally remote viewing the Soviets. Now, remember, the Soviets had a different set of procedures. They did not do training.
Right.
They got the best natural psychics and coordinated their activities, and they developed an 80% accuracy rate. Now, the U.S. team in the Pentagon targeted the Soviet team, and they sent a remote viewer there under highly controlled conditions. Again, the remote viewer was not told what the target was, and they just, you know, they just did the target. The remote viewer found himself looking at a conversation between a woman who turned out to be the high-ranking commander of the Soviet unit.
Right.
Having a conversation with somebody else. Now, this woman was a natural psychic, mind you. She didn't do all the complicated procedures that the U.S. team did.
Right.
So she had sort of natural abilities. And one of the first instances of its type happened during the session. The woman turned and looked directly at the spot where the American remote viewer was located inside the Kremlin, or inside, you know, in Moscow, and wherever the actual location of the remote viewing person was, the Soviet one.
Mm-hmm.
The remote viewer, the U.S. remote viewer in the Pentagon, then reported to the monitor that, with considerable surprise, that he was discovered.
Wow.
That the female actually looked at him after he described who she was. Then the monitor said, oh, this is a national security breach. We have to retract this immediately. So they ended the session and brought the American remote viewer immediately back into the Pentagon. And then the Soviet woman extended her consciousness out, because she was a natural, mind you. She didn't need all the elaborate preparatory stages that the American team needed.
Came right back at us.
She came right back at him moments later and followed him back and ended up in the Pentagon looking at them. And it was at that point that the Soviets started to bombard with probes the U.S. team, and that's when the psychic warfare really took off. Now, in addition to that, to answer your question, one of the scientific discoveries in laboratories, and actually this happened at Stanford Research Institute, SRI International,
yes.
Palo Alto in California, formerly associated with Stanford University, and they later had to break off because of the Vietnam War, students were upset that the university was accepting so many defense dollars, so the SRI International had to break off. But in the research laboratory, Ingo Swann, who was the original developer of the original military protocols, was sent to a target and completely identified the target and described it and so on. A couple years later, Joe McMonagle, one of the natural psychics that was being tested at SRI International, was sent to the same target a couple years later.
Yes.
And Joe McMonagle, who was one of the military remote viewers, again, he was a natural, not one of the trained remote viewers, he was one of the natural remote viewers. He was sent to the same target in the laboratory at Stanford Research Institute and started to describe the exact same target. And then at near the end of the session, he said, but there's one thing that's odd. Over my shoulder, behind me, Ingo Swann is standing there. So what actually happened was, you see, when you remote view, it's not an out-of-body experience, but some aspect of yourself sort of materializes or becomes part of the scene, and another remote viewer can perceive it. So that once you remote view something, you actually become part of the history of that spot. And, for example,
something
in my book,
of you, in effect, remains there.
It remains there for forever.
Wow.
And in my book, I was given in my book Cosmic Voyage, as a what they call a calibration target, just to check on the it's a verifiable target, just to check on your use of the procedures. I was given the target under totally blind conditions again, the Battle of Gettysburg, and you know after doing the procedures, I did end up at the Battle of Gettysburg and describing it and even identifying it at the end of the session. This is the Battle of Gettysburg. It was a horrendous scene. It was very emotional because I never saw so much life ended.
Don't you come out of them drained? I mean, how can you go through the Battle of Gettysburg, seeing it, feeling it?
That often does happen. Some of our remote viewers go through a couple sessions, three or four sessions a week, and some of them go through one a week, depending on the nature of the session. If the target is the Eiffel Tower, there's not much draining there. But in that case, for example, in the Battle of Gettysburg, that was really quite an experience for me,
yes,
to see that many people kill themselves. And if some other remote viewer were to go to the Battle of Gettysburg and to poke around long enough, they'd eventually find me, meaning they'd see something, they'd call it, there's some subspace being hovering above the battle.
I'm with you, Doctor. Listen to me for a second. While I ask this, doesn't this go back to our discussion of the nature of time?
Well, this is a fascinating subject. We now know that time, in reality, does not exist. Let me explain.
Well, that would seem to validate it, is what I was saying.
Yeah, but there's more to it, and you will be shocked when you hear this, because when I heard it, it shook me to my absolute boots. The problem is the following. We found out that time really doesn't exist. What we have when we're in this 3+1 dimensional world, in these physical bodies, what we have is not time. What we have is the limitation of perception. When we're looking with our eyes, it's as if we're looking out the window of a fast-moving train. And everything that blurs past the window we see, but in a moment it's gone. And just because a train passes by a tree and you can momentarily see it, but then you can't see it anymore,
yes,
it doesn't mean that the tree doesn't still exist. What we found is that there's no experiential difference at all when you remote view something in the past, present, or future.
Right.
It's as if it's all in the here and now. And what we now know is that since time really doesn't exist, the only thing that exists is a limitation of our perception, so we can only see instantaneously what's occurring in the now.
Gotcha.
What we really have is a situation in which the past still exists. It never went away. Our limitation of perception limited our ability to see it, but it's still there. And the most amazing thing about this, when it hit me, when I realized that for the first time, I said, oh, my Lord,
sure.
That means the Holocaust is still going on. Everything that was bad, everything that was good, still exists.
It's
not gone anymore. We just can't see it. Everything that ever happened and ever will happen is in the here and the now. The only thing that's different is we can't perceive it unless we use specialized procedures that allow our soul to get that information about what's in the here and now, in the past and the present and the future, to our physical electrochemical minds. Our limitation of perception is the only thing that's stopping our realization that the past, present, and the future all exist. That means that the future can perceive the past, and it is possible for the past, present, and the future to interact.
Sure.
And this is another interesting lesson to learn. If you have some of your listeners out there who have seen flying saucers, UFOs, ETs, and they saw them in the sky and felt fear, perhaps, they should discard that fear, because in very great reality, you never know what you're looking at. Who's flying that saucer? We now know that there are extraterrestrials, truly,
and
different
species. And when
but
are
some
they?
Of them,
and
some
when,
of them
and,
are future humans.
And when are they, I was going to say. Yeah.
Well, the point
look,
is...
Doctor, I've got to ask you about something. If I don't,
okay.
My fax machine will burn up. Everybody asks you, it's got to be the question,
right.
And you have to have targeted it, I hope. Hi, Art, can you ask the doctor, please, if Oswald was the lone gunman?
Oh, well, let me say, you know, I'm going to give you an answer that you're not going to be satisfied with, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. We have targeted the assassination of JFK, for sure. But we have not made a project out of it which would answer that question. We send trainees there regularly, and we do, in fact, get... one of the sessions... of a trainee doing the JFK assassination is up on our webpage.
It is.
Yeah, so you can actually go to it. I forget which. We only have results for 11 people up there right now, but by the end of the summer we'll have over 30 up there. We're trying to get the results up as fast as manpower allows.
Well, what
but
are we
got 11, but one of them near the end, I think it's number 11 or 10 or something, is the JFK assassination. And the trainee was not sent to all the different aspects of the target. That trainee was sent, for example, to just the JFK assassination, the basics. And they got the horror, they got all the details, the person in the car and the metallic vehicle moving, the whole thing. Other viewers have targeted it and actually followed bullets and actually got to it and figured out what it was during the session. In fact, it was so powerful. But to answer that question of whether Oswald was the sole gunman, requires a project with multiple remote viewers, professional remote viewers, not trainees, but professionals focusing on just that one target. And there are so many important projects that are with us right now. We haven't had a chance to do that one. But we do have lots of trainees go to that target, and it's a very interesting target. And some of the results can be found on the Internet as we speak.
Okay, all right. And there could be further news.
Oh, yeah, we could resolve that if we had the manpower to just focus just on that. We could resolve that.
All right. Please ask Mr. Brown if he agrees with Ed Dames. Let me tell you what Ed Dames said. Two major things, Professor. One, that he saw massive numbers of babies dying. And the second, that he saw massive problems for life forms here on Earth due to the jet stream. Literally coming down on deck and producing tremendous winds on Earth. These are things that he's certain of. Have your viewers seen anything that would suggest the same sort of thing?
Well, let me say one thing. You know, it's very important for me to differentiate myself and what we're doing here at the Forest State Institute and with what other people are doing, because... It's people can only speak for themselves.
Understood.
And with regard to what other remote viewers have done, understand that our procedures that we have used, that we're now using and teaching at the Farsight Institute, have evolved from the original military procedures, and that while the information can be gotten, but there was nothing wrong with the military procedures, just that there's been innovation from that. And I feel it's very important for your listeners to understand that if I say, no, we haven't seen something or something else, that doesn't mean
that it wasn't seen.
That, you know, it's like the closet you look at. You only look at what you see. You only see what you've looked at.
Fair enough.
Some of these things that you'll mention that other remote viewers have seen may differ from what we get, in part because we have not looked at certain things, and in also part because we're not doing things quite as they were doing them or still are doing them sometimes, and we're doing different procedures, and time will tell with regard to our changes, our evolutionary changes in the procedures, whether the accuracy or whatever is different, whatever.
All right, so
now,
again,
with regard to the changes that you're talking about,
yes.
those particular changes,
yes.
Not commenting on that particular person's work, but just commenting about Earth changes.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not saying, I'm not comparing what I'm saying now to that person.
Okay.
I'm just saying you've asked me about Earth changes, and
yes,
then you can make the comparison yourself.
Go ahead.
However
indeed,
you want.
Indeed.
There definitely are climatic differences, changes that are coming. We are, and I write about these in my book, Cosmic Voyage, in quite detail. Whether that's involved with a jet stream changing or something else, you know, those are things that I'm, you know, those are details that I we've not looked at.
All right,
I don't know. But the point is that the climatic changes that are coming are not just climate in the terms of global warming, ozone stuff, and things like that, but the fundamental driver of this whole thing is our population on the planet. And in the book, Cosmic Voyage, I report remote viewing, extensive remote viewing, that goes as far as 400 years out
yes.
into the future. And what we do know, this may sound strange, but it's true. The future is not deterministic. It's not set in stone. It's probabilistic. Now, what this exactly means, we're not sure, but we do know that the future can change. That's why we have the future beings, say yourself. You could be looking at a flying saucer and not realize that a future version of yourself is actually the pilot. So how could you be afraid of yourself? But the point is that the future actually can interact with the past, and the timeline can change.
All right,
so
what
I'm going to say is we have seen some dramatic changes on the planet that
Like what?
Well, if you go out 30, 40 years, you start seeing population problems really being very severe. And
as in diminishing?
No, in the population's still growing, but you're running out of food, you're getting starvation in various places. By the time you get to the year 2075, which is less than 100 years away, I mean, you're not talking very far, actually.
That's right.
You're talking the when your children and grandchildren are running around and having, you know, that their robust time.
Yes.
You start entering a Mad Max scenario, and it's quite clear at this point that the civilization has to hunker down and go into underground shelters.
Underground shelters.
Yeah, the population comes apart, the political systems fall apart. There are roving gangs on the surface. The population basically survives in underground bunkers, very large encampments, and it's not everybody that gets to go in the bunkers. Most people slug it out on the surface.
Right,
and
God.
If you go out to 250 years, you find the only inhabitants are the people in the underground bunkers. And the best of the world is barren, basically. And if you go out as far as 300 years, you start seeing that the Earth is being terraformed again by humans slowly coming out of the bunkers. And if you go out 400 years, you see sort of a Garden of Eden. The humans are much wiser, much smarter, much more careful about their environment, and very carefully putting greenhouses all over the place in the sense of re-terraforming and bursting the whole planet into life. I have not gone out further than 400 years. Robert Monroe at the Monroe Institute, when he was still alive, he and some others had gone out as far as 1,000 years, and they found a completely reborn planet. I mean, completely reborn, robust and very wise humans that are completely reoriented with regard to their role as not users and abusers of the planet, but caretakers. So we are going through a shift. Humanity does not get wiped out, but we have some hard times ahead.
Excuse me if I say, holy smokes. Doctor, hold on. We need to get to the phones, and we'll do that next hour if you're up for it.
I'm up for it, and we should also get to the ETs. The book Cosmic Voyage is all about those, and
that's the
bottom line of the whole thing.
Believe me, we will. And if you knew how much what you just said sounds like what Major Dame said, I guess you'd probably start digging.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Well, once again, here I am. My guest is Professor Courtney Brown. And, oh my, what a program, huh? We're going to get back to the professor in a moment. He is a tenured PhD professor at Emory University. Dr. Brown heads a group of remote viewers at the Farsight Institute. And I have many questions, and I'm sure you do, and I will try my best to get phones open sometime this hour, I think.
Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
Back now to Professor Brown. Professor, suppose somebody were to go to New Mexico with big digging equipment and explosives and test your theory.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. If there was actually an attempt to physically extract the Martian base, hopefully the government would get involved. Besides, it is a national park, so that wouldn't be allowed, you see. A national park is a perfect place for such a situation.
That's
There's not
true.
Many people. It's a low-density state. The national park. The only thing they have to worry about is backpackers. Understand that the Martians have a technological ability that's not very far away for us even figuring out. The ETs, both Greys, by the way, we've gone 4 hours and we haven't even begun to talk about the Greys. You won't believe their story. They have an extraordinary, interesting story. We'll
it's right on my list.
Let me just mention that somehow there's a technological ability to change the phase vibrational something or other of matter so that physical matter can pass through other matter. ET ships don't need a tunnel to get through rock. they flick a switch and they go through. In the abduction phenomena, in the abduction literature, example, the stuff that's written about by John Mack, the professor.
Right through walls.
He writes extensively about how ETs pass people through walls, windows.
Right.
They never open the window.
That's right.
And the reality is, for the Martians to get to their base, they're flying their saucer, flying their ship. They flick a switch. They go right through the mountain and then flick the switch off when they get inside the hangar underneath the mountain. It's a perfect place. The only thing that they have to worry about is backpackers. So it's certainly a good enough place for a processing center for the next couple of some odd years while we're sorting ourselves out. But the remote viewing, I have a chapter about this in Cosmic Voyage, the remote viewing done under totally blind laboratory control type conditions of the future of that base is that eventually a tunnel is made into the base, and it becomes an immigration processing center.
Okay.
And so, you know, a tunnel is made, train tracks are put in through it. I mean, passing in and out with advanced ships may be okay for the Martians, but when it gets to humans putting people in and out on a processing center, immigration processing center, we're going to want tunnels and vehicles that can go in and out normally.
Okay, since time is short, I want to ask, I've had Graham Hancock on my program, Richard Hoagland on my program, and countless others who would tend to verify a great deal of what you're saying. So I've got to ask you about the pyramids.
Wait now.
The pyramids on Mars, the phase on Mars, and what we have at Giza, and how it relates to what you've been telling us, if it does.
Well, the Martian Cydonia complex, where the pyramid is, as well as the face and so on like that, those are clearly the ruins of an ancient Martian city. We send people there all the time. It's one of our favorite spots to send people because it's such a clear target. We send them back in time to the time when that place was actually active. And in fact, you see people running around, people doing things. You can actually see the city in dismay when a volcano erupts nearby. And when
really?
It's sort of like Pompeii when the volcano goes by. But also when the climatic problems start to occur, you see with the disruption of the city, because they didn't have a high technology back in those days. And so they were really terribly affected. And so that's clearly the remnants of a city. What Richard Hoagland and others have been saying about those being ruins is true. Those are ruins. And that's very near term. You're not going to have to wait for your kids and grandkids to know that. You'll know that in your own lifetime. Now, the other thing is Mars and Egypt, seems very, very parallel because we indeed have a Sphinx, we have pyramids and so on. And we have to remember that the word Cairo, the root of the word Cairo in Arabic is Mars. Cairo means Mars. That's the root of the word. And there was a tremendous parallel in culture between the Egyptians 3,000 years ago and the ancient Martians that were destroyed. There may be a very specific link between Mars and the ancient Egyptian culture. I don't know that link. We're trying to get more remote viewers to solve so many of these problems. But I don't believe in coincidences anymore. There's enough coincidental similarity to make me think that it's certainly worth a very good look, because the word Cairo means Mars, the pyramids, the face, the same type of stuff, the same ruins. It's too reminiscent of.
So these will be targets.
Yeah, but something like that has to be resolved in a project, and a project means a whole bunch of remote viewers.
I understand.
Remote viewing something under tightly controlled. I mean, you're dealing with professionals at this point, not just trainees.
Right.
Trainees have experiences, and we publicize that, and we put them up on the net. But many of these projects require professionals working, and we're getting that way. Let me tell you that there are many people in our professionalization program. After taking the Farsight Voyager, the first intensive one-week course, there are many people that have stayed with it and are going on to the professionalization program. Everybody that takes the course so far, absolutely every single person has had very clear remote viewing results. But the point is, we want many of those people to go on and become professionals, and as many as are intuitively driven or drawn, we want them to become teachers. We want them to be better than the best ever were. We want them to be better than myself. Every generation of remote viewers is going to be better than the past generation. So we're trying to get this institute expanded as much as possible. We know that the future of the Institute is very bright because we know that the things that are already out in the press, Cosmic Voyage, things like that, those are things that are just on the very near horizon for being verified. You know, the one thing is, we have known the remote viewing results for a long time. The laboratories have had solid evidence of remote viewing being an operational capability for three decades. But it's not made a dent on the planetary population. Scientists and others have been able to just simply disregard it and say it's just not relevant, or just say it didn't happen, like just to ignore it. But the reason Cosmic Voyage is so important as a book is it raises the stakes phenomenally because it's no longer a parlor trick. Now remote viewing, a demonstration of who we are as composite beings, remote viewing is now used to say something before it actually occurs.
Yes.
And when the actual ET stuff really hits, in the very near future, when we really all are as a planet talking about our interplanetary neighbors, then everybody will say, wow, remote viewing isn't a parlor trick. Consciousness really matters. This stuff was all known and published in advance of it actually occurring. That means that the understanding of who we are as beings, the nature of our soul, leaves the realm of idlers and enters the realm of the mainstream. And that is one of the most exciting planetary changes that we're going to be seeing.
The Martians are here. This is, all right, now this is, I want a serious answer to this question if I can get it.
Mm-hmm.
We have two choices, apparently, to accept them and allow them to, in effect, immigrate and come above ground as they apparently want to do, according to you, or to reject them, to fight them, to react as humans so frequently do, violently.
Mm-hmm.
If that is the case, would they, like a cornered animal, fight?
I don't think so. They don't have anything in their makeup to... They're not an aggressive, hostile species. They're so desperate right now, there'd be no benefit for them to do something like that.
Well, there is a modern expression about desperate people doing desperate things.
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand, your question raises a good point, and... it's probably one of the things that the generals are going to be talking to the president about, saying, look, we don't want a battle on our hands. If they're desperate, let's resolve this thing peacefully. Then if they need to get out of there and their only option is suicide, then let's resolve this and help them. But we have to understand there's something else. There are, we now know, and I've written about it, you know, all the things that I'm writing, talking about briefly here are in detail in the book Cosmic Voyage. It's available all the major bookstores. If they're sold out, they'll order it. So, you know, if your listeners are wanting to get the rest of the meat and potato, the meat
sure.
that goes on these bones, it's there. You don't have to wait to get it. And the reality is that when it comes to Martians, there are, I mentioned one base. It's a processing base underneath Santa Fe Baldy, outside of Santa Fe, inside a national forest in New Mexico. But there are other places on the surface where villages live, and they're basically mistaken as being thought that they're just sort of native, Native American, or actually not American, but in South America, Indian stock and things like that. But the point is that they're living a clandestine life because of the nature of their existence. But you have to understand, for example, inside the base, underneath Santa Fe Baldy, right here in the United States, in New Mexico, there is a nursery. And this is very typical of other nurseries that exist. There is a nursery where moms are taking care of kids. Now, you have to understand, a lot of those kids were born in that nursery. They were born here. That means, face the facts, we have a constitution. The reality is, some of those kids are American citizens. And their parents have legal rights for expedited green card status. So we have some real reasons for having... legal reasons for having a desire to lift our head up out of that sand like the proverbial ostrich and start saying, not only are we not alone, but some of them are us. And, you know, they don't need warheads. What they need is passports.
The Greys. Let's do it. Who are they?
Those Greys are interesting. You know, they've had a bad rep. What has happened with the Greys is the early abduction literature was filled with horror stories about how they were abducting people in the middle of the night, performing gynecological and urological experiments and procedures and
are
diseases.
They?
And, well, in a way, but the reality is we now know the whole picture. You see, back when we first got introduced to Grays, back in 1947, when in fact the Roswell thing did occur, we sent people there under totally blind conditions regularly because it's such an interesting target. There really was a crash. We can even now find, we occasionally target even the wreckage now where the remaining parts are, what laboratories the parts are and things like that. The point is that back in 1947 when we first found out as a government about the Grays, the government was put between a rock and a hard place. What could the military tell President Truman and all the other presidents afterwards? They could say, well, look, Mr. President, you can tell people on the radio or on television, whatever, that the ETs are here. They have extraordinarily advanced technology, that basically we're defenseless, and that they may be doing some things to our citizens that our citizens may not particularly like.
That's right.
Oh, by the way, Mr. President, the only other thing you could tell them is that everyone can panic at their own discretion. And every president since Truman has said the same thing. I'm not going on the air with that.
Well, I wouldn't either.
You've got to give me something better. There's got to be some hope at the end of this tunnel. And one of the main reasons for Cosmic Voyage is to give the other end of the picture, to give the information that was lacking back in 1947, so we now know that, in fact, we're not being invaded by a hostile species. If anything, the Grays are as helpful to us as they were to the Martians. They're the cavalry, the rescue corps. But the reality is the Grays are an extremely interesting, extremely benign and helpful species. Now, let me explain. They've had a lot of bad press. And the reason is because they're so different from us. Let's go back. The Grays, unlike the Martians, destroyed their own homeworld. It wasn't an interplanetary holocaust that was not of their own making. They were very similar to us, except they did not have the limitations that we have. They were completely telepathically aware even back then. But they were very similar to us in the sense they were burning themselves off their own home planet. They basically killed their own planet through wanton abuse of their environment, greed, selfishness, the works. And what happened is they had to go underground in order to survive, not too dissimilar to what we're going to be facing in 100 years, actually less than that, about 80. But the point is they had to go underground. And when they went underground, as a matter of survival, they had a collective nervous breakdown. They said, well, now we have to start fiddling with our science, our genes. Well, it'd be nicer if we were a little shorter because it's hard to walk around in these tunnels. It'd be nicer if we had larger eyes. There's not that much light down here, down under.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started to saying, well, you know, it's as smaller beings, it's harder to give birth. We might as well start raising our fetuses in tubes,
mm-hmm.
in like large canisters. And then they started to say, well, look, we're getting good at this genetic manipulation stuff. Why don't we solve the problem in the first place? Why don't we get rid of the rampant emotions, the greed, and everything else that we had that drove us to this stuff? And then they did the following. You know, when you have a happy experience, you have happy molecules that are created electrochemically in your brain. Mm-hmm. When you have an unhappy experience, you have unhappy molecules that are created. That's why a mood takes a little while to dissipate, because the molecules are still hanging around. And the Gray said, let's change our brains genetically so that we have only one electrochemical response to any stimulus that we get. And we'll try to advance spiritually. They were self-realized in the sense that they knew they were composite beings. We'll try to advance in the spiritual realm, and we'll get rid of all the anger, all the hostility, everything. They even got rid of love on the electrochemical level. And what they have is basically a society that's not that indifferent from Spock. Electrochemical brains that produce only one benign response to anything that happens to them. And they evolve spiritually tremendously. But they realized ultimately they were in a cul-de-sac, a dead end. The reason for them being composite beings, physical as well as subspace, was so that they could experience something in the physical realm. And then they realized that unless they had more emotional flexibility in their minds, they couldn't be like some of the very great beings that they discovered out in the realm. They needed to experience more, yet they were terrified of going back to their own past. They were terrified of their own past genetics because that's what led them into that problem of that collective nervous breakdown in the first place. They went to the Galactic Federation. All of this is explained out in detail, point by point, in the book Cosmic Voyage. And they went to the Galactic Federation, served as outstanding members of the Federation for many projects, including rescuing the Martians, for a long time. And they eventually, finally, submitted, like going for a National Science Foundation grant, they submitted their own application for help in a genetic uplift project for themselves. And they picked our planet, Earth, because of tremendous variety in genetic variation on this planet. And they applied to the Galactic Federation and said, may we have permission to go there and use the gene pool? They were awarded the grant. They were given permission. And then they get here. And what they do, you have to understand, we were alive before we were alive. We were alive before we were physical bodies. They go around, we've witnessed this countless times. They go around and people, human beings, or pre-human beings, people who before they are physical human beings, volunteer. And they say, countless times we've seen this. And the Greys ask for permission. And the people volunteer and say, when I am a physical human being, I am willingly going to participate in this so-called abduction phenomena so that you can get some of the genes to help uplift the species. By the way, I have to say, before the commercial happens, I have to tell you, we have to come to this at the next half hour. The project works. It is one of the most beautiful transformations of a species that anyone has witnessed on ever. And the point is that many humans volunteered before they were humans, knowing full well that when they did become humans, because of the limitations that we have self-imposed on ourselves with regard to our own genetics, that we would not remember the experience. And when you actually have an abduction experience, you don't remember that, in fact, you gave the permission. But the Greys are almost comical in the way that they ask permission for everything. And so the point is that when we remote view, say, for example, a woman, but it happens with men too, but a woman being abducted, being transported up to a Grey ship, having gynecological procedures going on and fetuses going in and out and so on, on the surface level, if you put a meter up to her electrochemical brain, it's like right off the meter. It would break the meter. Panic, chaos, horror, everything. But then the remote viewer can go deeper. And we have many times. You go into the subspace component, the subspace aspect of the person, the soul, and you find ecstasy, the reason for existence, fulfillment of purpose. And it doesn't make sense. And then the remote viewer has to travel back in time before the person was born, and you find a fully sentient being saying, I participate, and
all
I
right.
will participate.
Hold it right there. We'll be right back. Dr. Courtney Brown is my guest. There'll be more.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Sure is. My guest is Professor Courtney Brown from Emory University. He is a remote viewer. Actually, he heads a team and has the Farsight Institute that trains remote viewers. And we'll get back to him in a moment.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1996.
Back now to Dr. Brown. Doctor, they want you to talk more about the Grays. I've got a few phone calls I really, really want to get to, but I want to ask you, where are the Grays from?
They're from another planet. They're clearly not future humans. They're from another star system in our galaxy. We're not dealing with galaxies that are far away. By the way, we must understand something that's very exciting. One of the remote viewing sessions that was introducing this concept, we've later gotten it much more thoroughly, but the remote viewing that I've written about in the book, Cosmic Voyage, one of the remote viewing sessions indicated that we, when we got to the Galactic Federation headquarters, we actually had an interview. The military remote viewing was never interactive. It was always just, they disregarded any interaction, basically
right.
What happened. But we have gotten it to the point where we actually, with telepathically capable beings, you actually can get information backward and forward when you're doing the remote viewing, professionals can. And what we found out was that the Galactic Federation actually needs us. We're not just kids coming out of the daycare camp. There's actually a role for us to play. The Galactic mm-hmm. Federation is not spread throughout the entire galaxy. And it's literally like the Star Trek series. The Federation is expanding, and there's literally
somehow
worlds to explore and so on like that.
Somehow I'm not surprised. What you seem to suggest, though, is that genetically, without tampering, without changing genetically,
mm-hmm.
A race, any race, really, is ultimately doomed.
No. Listen.
That seems to suggest
nothing ever stays constant. So no, in that sense,
yes.
Everything is doomed. The point is, evolution is the only name of the game in town. There's no other game. The reason that the Grays are different from humans is that some beings prefer the Gray experience to existence over the human experience to existence. And we choose to enter the human realm and to participate in this human realm for a while till we get tired of it and move on. But the difference is that there is endless variation to existence, and some experiences are different than others, and the Grays experience life differently than us. Now, Art, before we run out of time, I just have to say one thing. I'm a very controlled remote viewer in the sense that I'm fully professional. I run a school. Actually, there's a number of people, or a whole bunch of us running it now, but the point is that in a remote viewing session, I never lose it in the sense of, you know, any emotions that I get are clearly put in the right spot, and they don't affect what I'm doing. But twice, I almost lost it. Let me tell you those two experiences. The first was when I remote viewed the future Grays, the result of this genetic project. The Grays found they needed a new experience, a different experience. They didn't want their old genetics. They wanted something brand new.
Mm.
They wanted parts of our genes. They don't want the whole thing. They consider us a dysfunctional species in some regards.
No, we are.
We're aggressive. We're territorial. We fight. Look at our divorce rate.
Mm.
Look at the way we treat kids a lot of times, all the homeless people. Well, they don't want our aggression, our hate, our anger, our fear, our territoriality. They don't want that. But they do want the love, the nurturing, the caring, all the good things. And so those are the genes that produce those type of electrochemical responses for love, caring, nurturing, things like that, that they're splicing in slowly but surely into their own genetic framework. And when we have remote viewed the future, the first time I did this, the future of the Grays, when you go to their planet, yes, they have a planet, a future planet. When you go to the planet where they take this race that literally is our grandchildren, they are our offspring. They're half us.
I understand.
And when you go to this planet and look at them and do a mind probe and perceive them, it's just one of the most beautiful things anyone could ever see. They're like, you know, we've also remote viewed famous personalities like Jesus, Buddha, things like that. Why not? They lived at one time. You can remote. They obviously, no one dies, so you can remote view them at any time. And the Jesus personality is a very interesting personality. When I remote viewed the Greys, the big difference between the personality of Jesus and the personality of the Greys was that Jesus had more of a command structure, more of a command personality, more of a, you know, sort of an authority type of, very pleasant. It's, you had to sort of experience it. The words don't do it justice. But Jesus is a very beautiful personality to remote view. We send trainees there from time to time. He's been very cooperative under completely blind situations. But with the Greys, it's like that. You get all the love, all the nurturing, all the caring, none of the hostility. They're like the types of people you want next door, the ones who always have a cup of sugar when you need it.
Good neighbors, yeah.
Now, the other time, the second time, that I almost lost it in a remote viewing session. And what that means is I almost had to just break off the session. The emotions,
right.
Emotions were so overwhelming. Is the emotions of the target were so overwhelming to me. Was when I remote viewed the Martian flotilla leaving Mars, finally. When the day of Exodus, like the Israelis, the Israelites leaving Egypt, the day of Exodus when they leave their prison planet and come here, that flotilla, it almost chokes me up when I just think about it, but the emotions of those people, the euphoria of coming to the promised land, Earth, coming out of their imprisonment to the promised land, it's the emotions inside that flotilla when it comes in our not-distant future is just one of the most remarkable states of emotional awareness that has ever been experienced by anybody.
All right.
They are happy to come here.
Doctor, we've got to take a couple of calls.
All right, go ahead.
I've got people waiting, so let's do it. First time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Brown. Hello.
Good morning, Art. You've absolutely outdone yourself this time. This is incredible. Dr. Brown, good morning to you.
Good morning, and I want to thank you for calling.
Where are you, sir?
Stem Beach, Colorado.
All right.
On KCSJ out of Pueblo.
Yes, sir.
And Dr. Brown, I'm a skeptic, but I'm an open-minded skeptic, and I'm one of these show me type people.
That's healthy.
I'm gonna get your book tomorrow, and I'm wondering if I'll be able to find information in that regarding your initial 1 week seminar there.
Absolutely. Well, actually, in the back of the book, there is a section for contacting the author at the Farsight Institute. So the P.O. box and everything, the address, is there in the book. I want to also say that on the web page, people can contact us on the web page, and we're also in the phone book and so on like that. So information about us is easily accessible. We have information packets plus applications that we mail out. In addition, if you go onto the web page, you can not only find out about us, but you can also see some of the student results. We're trying to get them posted as fast as we can. By the end of the summer, we'll have a whole bunch of new stuff, but we've got 11 people's stuff posted now, and lots more is coming.
All right.
Great.
But, yeah.
Thank you very much. So there's the answer, caller. All the information you need for contact is in the book. And the book is in just about any bookstore.
It's in all the bookstores.
Yeah.
It's selling very, very well. And I should also say that there eventually will be a paperback version, but that probably won't be till 1997. By the way, if a bookstore is sold out, just tell them to order it. They can get it quickly.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Professor Brown. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you?
I'm in Toronto, Canada.
Toronto, Canada. Okay, go ahead.
Dr. Brown, you were talking about Roswell, and
yes.
I was wondering if the Army has possession of the bodies, if there were bodies that were found, and if they were Martian or they were gray, or do you have any description on that?
Good question.
They were grays. They were not Martians. You know, the odd thing about that Roswell event, by the way, yes, the wreckage is still around. We even send some remote viewers from time to time to the current location of the wreckage. It's sort of, when you get to the point where you can do things like this, you have to think of new targets that will keep the...
Yeah, I understand. Where is the current record?
Actually, you know, to locate it geographically is something you can't do with a trainee, and that's all we've done. We send trainees to the actual location, and they get identical descriptions of this type of thing. But to locate the actual geographical location, you need a full project. And that we just have not had the resources to do yet.
Right.
Cosmic Voyage is a full project. We have some full projects. Cosmic Voyage is a printed, wonderful project.
I am beginning to understand the difference. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Brown. Hello.
Yes, Bill in Minnesota.
Yes.
Yes, Professor Brown. I'm wondering, how do your administrative supervisors at Emory University, how much do they know about your work and how do they feel about it?
Good question.
They know all about what I do, but I do different things at Emory than I do at the Farsight Institute. I've clearly separated them out. And also, they have a very great respect for academic freedom here at Emory. So at the Farsight Institute, which is a private institute, we teach the remote viewing, and we talk about these things. And at Emory University, I teach my courses in nonlinear mathematical applications of social scientific phenomena and other things like that.
Yes,
I keep those things basically separated, and Emory has a very, very strong tradition of intellectual freedom. It's one of the most prestigious universities in the country, but I must say that it started out as a Methodist university long, long ago. So it was founded on the basic idea that there is something real to the unseen.
I mean, now, are they generally supportive? They don't consider you sort of an oddball or something like that? Or...
Well, you know, it's more benign neglect than anything else, and that's the way it should be, because that's the way I've asked it to be that way.
All right, fair enough. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Brown. Hi.
Hi, this is Dawn. I'm calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
All right.
I have a question about, as far as the research you've done and your studies at the college there, have you ever had a situation where any of the controlled subjects have experienced or told you about control stations dealing with influences about remote viewing of a different kind, not so controlled, on a deeper level? Trying my best to attempt this.
Yeah, explain it a little bit more. I don't quite understand.
I have done remote viewing with control stations throughout the United States. I have worked with the government, the military. I am a subject of a different approach of that one aspect of remote viewing. And I've wondered if they had ever seen anything of the nature of, you know, government, computer systems, people literally beings tapping into your brain.
Really touching base on intensity here. I have no, you know, one of the good things about being a professor is you have the authority to say you don't know. And to be quite honest, I don't know. We haven't had any experiences of seeing anything like that. That doesn't mean something like that doesn't occur. I know some people in the military, in the official military remote viewing project, have stated to me on occasion that they think such things go on. And some of the, I don't know, but I don't know anything about it.
Okay, good enough. Let's continue. We only have a very few moments, and I've kind of ignored the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Brown. Hello? Oh, wait a minute. Now let's try it. Hello there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Where are you, please?
I'm in southern Utah.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask Courtney Brown a question.
Sure.
My question is, I know Joe McMonagle. I was at Monroe Institute for two different weeks.
Great.
I'd like to find out phone numbers on how to get hold of his Farsight Institute.
Do you want to give that out, Doctor?
Oh, sure. Actually, the best way is to write us, though, because we're overwhelmed after a show like this with the phones, and... I will give out the phone number, but let me give out two phone numbers.
All right.
The fax number is often good because something physically written, like a letter or a fax, is always better because we have an address we can clearly get. And the fax number is 404-636-5148. 404-636-5148. And if you fax us your address and so on like that, then we can get information packets to you.
All right.
The regular phone number... And if the secretary is not in, there'll be a computer voicemail system that will allow you to leave address and so on like that, is 404-320-2007, 404-320-2007. But it's much better to, rather than leave a voice message, it's much better to actually write us at Farsight Institute, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, one word, like seeing far, at P.O. Box 49243. 49243, that's P.O. Box 49243, Atlanta, Georgia, 30359. Now, that's ZIP Atlanta, Georgia, 30359. The address for that is in the back of the book, Cosmic Voyage. And for people who are interested in remote viewing training, the very good first step is often just to get the book and ask us for an information packet, and we send it right out. And those people who do have Internet access, of course, you can get immediate satisfaction by just zipping to our homepage.
Say, Doctor, you are right now at the home of the Olympics, which have just gotten underway. You have not taken a look at whether they're going to be safe, have you?
No, we haven't looked at that. You know, you have to understand there's so many projects and the things that are sort of current events happening right now. It's very hard, given the number of people we have trained so far, to mobilize things for something like that. In the future, when there are literally more remote viewers and more projects going on, then we'll be able to do things like that. But at this current time, I'm just looking like everybody else is looking at the television and wondering what's happening.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Brown. Hi.
Yes, hello. This is Mike in Lexington, Kentucky.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I tuned in a little bit late, so I apologize if this has already been answered. I'm like one of the other callers. I'm a little bit skeptical of some of this. I was wondering if Dr. Brown could give us any kind of an unequivocal, undeniable future event in the near future so that we can confirm this really works.
Well, absolutely. Go out and buy the book Cosmic Voyage. I put my whole reputation on the line with that. The point is, it's printed. It's in print. And it's either true or it's not true. You don't have to argue about it. In the sense of someone can say across the street, you can talk to them and say, well, what do you think? And they can want to get into an argument with you about it. And you know what you can say? They say, hey, there's no reason to argue. Let's just wait a little while. Patience is a virtue. And if it turns out to be true, you'll know it. The book is the proof. If it turns out that there are no Martians, that there are no grays, then, you know, I'm ruined. I'm not a gambler, and I'm not going to be ruined. But the point is, the book is the proof. It's the biggest proof that'll ever be needed. In fact, it's written precisely to be that way, so that the question of whether we actually have a composite nature, whether remote viewing actually works, that will be totally and irrevocably removed from our setting, from our agenda, forever when the ET stuff finally happens.
Well, Doctor, we're running out of time.
It's been a joy. It has been a joy.
It really has been a pleasure to have you. And we will, obviously, there's so much untouched ground that we will have you back again.
Well, I would be very pleased and always honored whenever you invite me to come.
Doctor, get some sleep.
I shall.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Art, and you have a great day.
And good night. All right, everybody. That was Professor Courtney Brown. And many, many, many of you have requested his presence on this program for a long time. And so we finally connected. Now, I would like to close by thanking all of you who have no doubt stayed with us throughout the night. I will tell you, to get a copy of the absolutely incredible program that you just heard, you can call 24 hours a day, 1-800-917-4278. Please jot that number down. 1-800-917-4278. That would be the program you just heard with Professor Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute and Emory University. I will be back Sunday night at 7 Pacific with Dreamland. And then we'll be interviewing Constantinos on the subject of vampires. That should be interesting. Back Monday night, Tuesday morning with Coast and who knows what. I never know about this program. So, from my heart and from the desert, good night, America.